to these problems if we choose to acknowledge them, however. The authors of the Women Equals Homemaker paper devised a new algorithm that reduced gender stereotyping, e.g. he is to doctor as she is to nurse, by over two-thirds, while leaving gender-appropriate word associations, e.g. he is to prostate cancer as she is to ovarian cancer, intact. And the authors of the 2017 study on image interpretation devised a new algorithm that decreased bias amplification by 47.5%. Chapter 9. A Sea of Dudes. When Jenica Alvarez was trying to raise funds for her tech startup, Naya Health Inc., in 2013, she struggled to get investors to take her seriously. In one meeting, investors Googled the product and ended up on a porn site. They lingered on the page and started cracking jokes, leaving Alvarez feeling like she was in the middle of a fraternity. Other investors were too grossed out to touch her product or pleaded ignorance, with one male investor saying, "I'm not touching that, that's disgusting." And what was this vile, disgusting, and incomprehensible product Alvarez was pitching? Listener, it was a breast pump. The odd thing is, the breast pump industry is one that is ripe for disruption, as Silicon Valley would have it. Breast pumping is huge business in the US in particular. Given the lack of legally mandated maternity leave, for most American women, breast pumping is the only option if they want to follow their doctor's recommendations and breastfeed their babies for at least 6 months. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that women try to breastfeed for at least 12 months. And one company, Medela, has pretty much cornered the market. According to the New Yorker, 80% of hospitals in the United States and the United Kingdom stock Medela's pumps, and its sales increased 34% in the 2 years after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which mandated coverage of lactation services, including pumps. But the Medela pump is just not very good. Writing for the New Yorker, Jessica Winter described it as a hard, ill-fitting breast shield with a bottle dangling from it, which, as it sucks milk out of a woman's breast, pulls and stretches the breast like it's taffy, except that taffy doesn't have nerve endings. And although some women manage to make it work hands-free, most can't because it doesn't fit well enough. So they just have to sit and hold their personal milking contraptions to their breasts for 20 minutes a time, several times a day. So, to sum up, captive market, currently estimated at $700 million with room to grow? Check. Products that aren't serving consumers' needs? Check. Why aren't investors lapping it up? Addressing the underrepresentation of women in positions of power and influence is often framed as a good in itself. And, of course, it is. It is a matter of justice that women have an equal chance of success as their equally qualified male colleagues. But female representation is about more than a specific woman who does or doesn't get a job, because female representation is also about the gender data gap. As we saw with Sheryl Sandberg's story about pregnancy parking, there will be certain female needs men won't think to cater for because they relate to experiences that men simply won't have, and it's not always easy to convince someone a need exists if they don't have that need themselves. Dr. Tanya Bowler, founder of women's health tech company Chiaro, thinks that the reluctance to back female-led companies is partly a result of the stereotype that men like great design and great tech, and women don't. But is this stereotype based in reality, or is it possible that the problem isn't tech-blind women so much as woman-blind tech, created by a woman-blind tech industry and funded by woman-blind investors? A substantial chunk of tech startups are backed by venture capitalists, VCs, because they can take risks where banks can't. The problem is that 93% of VCs are men, and men back men, explains Debbie Voskov, co-founder of Albright, a members club, academy, and fund that backs female-led business. We need to have more women writing checks, and men need to recognize that backing women is a great investment. Voskov tells me that when she was in the process of setting up Albright with her friend Anna Jones, the former CEO of Hearst, men who should know better, to be honest, would frequently tell them, "That's lovely. It's great that you and Anna have set up a charity." Voskov bristles at this. "We're not a charity. We're doing this because women deliver great economic returns." The data suggests she's not wrong. Research published in 2018 by Boston Consulting Group found that although on average female business owners receive less than half the level of investment their male counterparts get, they produce more than twice the revenue. For every dollar of funding, female-owned startups generate 78 cents, compared to male-owned startups, which generate 31 cents. They also perform better over time, generating 10% more in cumulative revenue over a 5-year period. This may be partly because women are better suited for leadership than men. That was the conclusion of a study conducted by BI Norwegian Business School, which identified the 5 key traits: emotional stability, extroversion, openness to new experiences, agreeableness, and conscientiousness of a successful leader. Women scored higher than men in 4 out of the 5. But it may also be because the women who do manage to make it through are filling a gender data gap. Studies have repeatedly found that the more diverse a company's leadership is, the more innovative they are. This could be because women are just innately more innovative, but more likely is that the presence of diverse perspectives makes businesses better informed about their customers. Certainly, innovation is strongly linked to financial performance. And when it comes to consumer electronics for women, Bola says innovation has been sorely lacking. There's never been much innovation in consumer electronics for women, she says. It's always focused on a very superficial aesthetic level, turn something pink or turn something into a piece of jewellery, rather than taking account of the fact that technology can solve real problems for women. The result has been a chronic lack of investment, meaning that the actual technology that's used in medical devices for women is sort of a kickback from the 1980s. When I interview her early in 2018, Tanya Bola is about to launch her own breast pump, and she is scathing about what is currently available on the market. It's just horrible, she says, bluntly. It's painful, it's loud, it's difficult to use, it's quite humiliating. I think of trying to hold a conversation with my sister-in-law as she sits on the sofa with her top off, her breasts wired up to a machine. It's not even that complicated to get it right, Bola adds. The notion that it would be nice to pump while you're able to do something else rather than having to spend hours a day sitting there chained to this noisy machine should, she says, be a basic requirement. But somehow it hasn't been. When I ask her why she thinks this is, Bola muses that perhaps it's different for her because she's a woman. So I just go in with, as a woman, what do I want from this? But if the data gap of what women actually want is fairly easily fixed by, well, asking women, there's another more chronic gap. Data on the female body itself. Bola developed her first product, Alvi, a smart pelvic floor trainer, after realizing that poor pelvic floor health in women was a massively hidden epidemic. 37% of women suffer from pelvic floor issues. 10% of women will need to have an operation at some point because of prolapse, where your organs start dropping through your vagina. This rises to 50% of women over 50. There's a sense of injustice, says Bola. It's a big issue for women, and it should be a normal part of how women look after their bodies, but you need to have information and data in order to do that. And when Bola was first researching the issue, that data simply didn't exist. We were trying to design a product which fits in the vagina, and so we needed to answer simple questions like what size, how does it vary by age, by race, after children, all the usual questions. And there was just no data there at all. 50% of the population have a vagina, she continues, and yet there's hardly any journal articles about this part of anatomy. 3 years ago, I found about 4 articles done decades ago. One of them was literally by a guy who basically made a kind of plaster cast, like a mold inside the vagina, and concluded that there were 4 shapes, a mushroom and a cone and a heart. She trails off laughing. Problems with pelvic floor health are often preventable. And the evidence base for pelvic floor training is very strong, Bola tells me. It's the number one line of defense, and it's recommended under the NICE, National Institute for Health and Case Excellence, guidelines in the UK. But when she started looking at the technology in hospitals, there had been no investment. It was so outdated, it was very unreliable and not even very valid. The current treatment for prolapse, to insert a mesh into the vagina, is the subject of an ongoing scandal in the UK, as hundreds of women have been left in severe, debilitating pain by what they describe as barbaric treatment. In Scotland, a woman just died. Ida Tin, founder of menstrual tracking app Clue, encountered the same problem when she started trying to find an alternative to traditional contraception. Menstruation is listed as one of the vital signs of the body, she tells me. The same as, do you have a heart rate? Are you breathing? What's your body temperature? It's a really strong indication of your health. And yet, it's also an area where there is so much taboo and misinformation. As for family planning, Tin points out that there's been very little innovation since the pill came out in the 1950s. I mean, in the history of technology, that's a really long time. Tin set up Clue because she wanted to enable women to take control of their own body and lives. But the motivation was also personal. She'd tried the pill, but like many women, she'd had side effects. and I hadn't had any children, so an IUD wasn't ideal. So I'd been using condoms for 15 years. In frustration, Tin started looking at patent databases, but everything was about putting hormones into the body, she tells me, and I felt it was a very non-data-driven approach to this problem. It made me a little bit provoked, like, why is it that nobody has given this some serious effort and consideration? It's a pretty basic need for humankind. When she had the idea for the menstrual tracking app, there were only a couple of period tracking apps available, and they were very first-generation products, basically a calendar that can count to 28, and if only our biology was that simple, she laughs. After a decade of being in the sector, Tin says, the science is still riddled with gaps. There really is a lack of data, she tells me. Menstruation has been not just overlooked, but borderline actively ignored. We do a lot of work together with science institutions because there really are a lot of blank areas on the academic map, like what's even considered a normal bleeding pattern for an adolescent woman. That's one of the things we've been working on with Stanford. Science just doesn't know what's normal. Given the male domination of VCs, data gaps are perhaps particularly problematic when it comes to tech aimed at women. If you don't have good data, explains Tin, it's harder to open people's minds that something might be an issue if they don't encounter it themselves. Bowler agrees. We did talk to some VC investors who didn't believe LV was an interesting proposition, she tells me. The other problem women face when it comes to getting investment is pattern recognition. A corollary of culture fit. Pattern recognition sounds data-driven, but it's basically just a fancy term for looks similar to something that has worked in the past, where something could be white male founder who dropped out of Harvard and wears hoodies. Genuinely, I dated a guy who was working on a startup and he referenced this uniform when he was talking about getting funding. Hoodie-based pattern recognition is real. And this emphasis on recognizing a typically male pattern may be exacerbated by the common belief that tech is a field where inborn genius, which as we've seen is stereotypically associated with men, is more important than working hard, hence fetishizing Harvard dropouts. It all feels rather catch-22-ish. In a field where women are at a disadvantage specifically because they are women and therefore can't hope to fit a stereotypically male pattern, data will be particularly crucial for female entrepreneurs. And yet it's the female entrepreneurs who are less likely to have it because they are more likely to be trying to make products for women, for whom we lack data. Still, some do manage to break through. Tin and Bowler got their funding. Bowler, in part from Voskoff, and now these specific data gaps are starting to be filled. Before they launched, Chiaro had over 150 women test their pelvic floor trainer, Bowler tells me. But we now have data on over a million workouts, and we have a lot of measurements around pelvic floor health which just haven't existed before. This, she says, is the exciting thing about wearable tech, giving people better information about their bodies so they can make more informed decisions. But while Bowler's and Tin's products may give women better information about their bodies, the same can't be said for all new tech, wearable or otherwise. In the tech world, the implicit assumption that men are the default human remains king. When Apple launched its health monitoring system with much fanfare in 2014, it boasted a comprehensive health tracker. It could track blood pressure, steps taken, blood alcohol level, even molybdenum. Nope, me neither. And copper intake. But as many women pointed out at the time, they forgot one crucial detail, a period tracker. This was not to be the only time Apple completely forgot about at least 50% of their users. When Apple launched their AI, Siri, she, ironically, could find prostitutes and Viagra suppliers, but not abortion providers. Siri could help you if you'd had a heart attack, but if you told her you'd been raped, she replied, "I don't know what you mean by I was raped." These are basic errors that surely would have been caught by a team with enough women on it, that is, by a team without a gender data gap. Products marketed as gender neutral that are in fact biased towards men are rife across the male-dominated tech industry. From smartwatches that are too big for women's wrists to map apps that fail to account for women's desire for safest in addition to fastest routes to measure how good you are at sex apps called iThrust and iBang. And yes, the inbuilt assumptions of what constitutes good sex are exactly what the names imply. The tech industry is rife with examples of tech that forget about women. Virtual reality, VR, headsets that are too big for the average woman's head, a haptic jacket, a jacket that simulates touch, that fits snugly on a male body but on a female reviewer's body could have fit over a puffy winter coat, augmented reality glasses whose lenses are too far apart for a woman to focus on the image or whose frames immediately fall off my face, or as I know from my experience of going on TV and giving public lectures, Mic packs that require either a waistband or substantial pockets to attach to. Out goes pretty much every dress ever designed. Defaulting to male seems particularly endemic in sports tech. Starting with the most basic, the calorie count on treadmills is perfect for practically no one. But it will be more accurate for your average man, because its calculations are based on the average male weight. The default setting for calorie count on most exercise machines is for a person who weighs 11 stone. And although you can change the weight setting, that still leaves a calculation based on an average male calorie burn. Women generally have a higher fat and lower muscle distribution than men, as well as different ratios of various muscle fibers. What this means at a basic level is that even after accounting for weight difference, men on average will burn 8% more calories than a woman of the same weight. The treadmill does not account for this. There's no reason to think that things improved much with the advent of wearables, either. One study of 12 of the most common fitness monitors found that these underestimated steps during housework by up to 74%. That was the Omron, which was within 1% for normal walking or running, and underestimated calories burned during housework by as much as 34%. Anecdotally, Fitbits apparently failed to account for movement while doing the extremely common female activity of pushing a pram. Yes, of course men push prams too, but not as often as the women who do 75% of the world's unpaid care. Another study, which unusually did manage to find almost 50% female participants, found that fitness devices were overestimating calorie burn by significant amounts. Unfortunately, they failed to disaggregate their data, so it is impossible to know if there were any sex differences. Tech developers even forget women when they form the potential majority of customers. In the US, women make up 59% of people over the age of 65 and 76% of those living alone, suggesting a potential greater need for assistive technology like fall detection devices. The data we have suggests that not only do older women fall more often than men, they also injure themselves more when they do. Data analysis of a month's worth of emergency department visits in the US found that of the 22,560 patients seen for fall injuries, 71% were women. The rate of fracture was 2.2 times higher in women, and women had a hospitalization rate 1.8 times that of men. And yet, despite women's arguably greater need, as well as research indicating that women tend to fall differently for different reasons and in different places, gender analysis is missing from the development of this technology. In one meta-analysis of 53 fall detection device studies, only half of them even described the sex of participants, let alone delivered sex disaggregated data. Another study noted that, despite extensive literature on falls among seniors, little is known about gender-specific risk factors. The proceedings of the 2016 International Conference on Intelligent Data Engineering and Automated Learning points out that a notable motivation for elders to reject fall detection devices is their size, suggesting mobile phones as a solution. Except, this isn't really a solution for women, because as the authors themselves note, women tend to keep their phones in their handbags, where fall detection algorithms will likely fail because they are trained to detect falls through acceleration sensors close to the body trunk. In acknowledging this, the authors are unusual. Whitney Erin Basil, a researcher at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, is a member of the Quantified Self community, which promises self-knowledge through numbers. These numbers are often collected via passive tracking apps on your phone, the classic being how many steps you've taken that day. But there's a pocket-sized problem with this promise. Inevitably, some dude gets up at a conference and says something about how your phone is always on you, Basil told The Atlantic, and every time I'll stand up and be like, "Hi, about this phone that is always on you? This is my phone, and these are my pants." Designing passive tracking apps as if women have pockets big enough to hold their phones is a perennial problem with an easy solution. Include proper pockets in women's clothing, she types furiously, having just had her phone fall out of her pocket and smash on the floor for the 100th time. In the meantime, however, women use other solutions, and if tech developers don't realize women are being forced into workarounds, they may fail in their development. A Cape Town-based tech company fell into this trap when they developed an app to help community health workers monitor HIV-positive patients. The app fulfilled all the usability requirements. It was easy to use, adaptable to local language, and solved a very specific issue. More than this, the community health workers were excited at the prospect of using it. But when the service was launched, it proved to be a flop. Despite several attempts to solve it, the problem remained a mystery until a new design team took over the project, a team that happened to have a woman in it. And this woman took only a day to discover the problem. It turned out that in order to more safely complete their daily commute into the townships where their patients lived, female health workers were concealing their valuables in their underwear, and the phone was too big to fit in their bras. Gender affects the kinds of questions we ask, says Margaret Mitchell, senior research scientist at Google. Limiting AI developers to one gender, she told Bloomberg News, puts companies in a position of myopia. Gaynor Williams, ex-director of user experience at Microsoft, agrees. In a blog post titled, Are You Sure Your Software is Gender Neutral?, Williams explains that all product design begins by deciding which problem needs solving, and that is all a matter of perception. What problem were NASA scientists solving when they decided to give Valkyrie, their space navigation robot, breasts? On the topic of sexy robots, even if men do identify a problem that affects us all, that doesn't mean that without female input they will come up with the right solution. When in retaliation for women denying him the sex to which he believed he was entitled, Alec Minassian mowed down and killed 10 people in Toronto with a rented van, the New York Times published a column headlined The Redistribution of Sex, which argued that sex robots could be the answer to the plight of men who can't convince women to sleep with them. Feminists might argue that the solution is instead to challenge male sexual entitlement. When it comes to the tech that ends up in our pockets, I'm ever hopeful, it all comes down to who is making the decisions. And like the world of venture capitalists, the tech industry is dominated by men. Margaret Mitchell calls this the sea of dudes problem. Over the past 5 years, she's worked with around 10 women and hundreds of men. Across professional computing as a whole in the US, 26% of jobs are held by women compared to the 57% of jobs women hold across the entire US workforce. In the UK, women make up 14% of the STEM workforce. As well as a rash of sexy robots, the sea of dudes leads to products like the enormous robot research prototype called PR2 that computer scientist and co-founder of a robotics company, Tessa Lau, encountered when she worked for robotics research lab Willow Garage. It weighed hundreds of pounds, it's much larger than a smaller woman, and it has two big arms. It looks really scary. I didn't even want one of those things near me if it wasn't being controlled properly. When I interviewed her a couple of years ago, roboticist Angelica Lim told me a similar story about the robot she encountered at a conference in Slovenia, which would come and shake your hand if you waved at it. When she waved at this 5'8" robot on wheels, the average American woman is 5'4", the robot slowly turned towards her, put out its hand, and then came barreling towards me fast, making her jump backwards and shriek. Contrast these examples to the virtual reality headset trialled by tech journalist Addie Robertson. The headset was meant to track her eyes, but it didn't work for her, until an employee asked if she was wearing mascara. When it got recalibrated perfectly a few minutes later, I was surprised, not by the fact that it worked, but by the fact that anyone had thought to troubleshoot makeup. Incidentally, she writes, this was one of the only VR startups I've ever covered with a female founder. Most VR companies aren't founded by women, however, and so the VR experience often comes with an inbuilt male bias. Like much of the online world, VR gaming seems to have a sexual harassment problem, and this problem is something VR's mainly male developers are routinely forgetting to account for. When author and gamer Jordan Bellemere tried the VR game Quiver in multiplayer mode, she was sexually assaulted by another user called BigBro442. Virtual makes it sound like it isn't real, but it felt real to Bellemere. And no wonder. VR is meant to feel real, and it can be so successful at tricking your brain that it is being explored as a treatment for PTSD, phobias, even phantom limb syndrome. To be fair to the male designers of Quiver, they had an excellent and proactive response to Bellemere's blog. They immediately redesigned their personal bubble setting, in which other players' hands disappear if they come close to your face, to cover the entire body, and so make such groping impossible. But as they themselves noted, while they had thought of the possibility of some silly person trying to block your view with their hands and ruining the game, they hadn't thought of extending the fading function to the rest of the body. How, they asked, could we have overlooked something so obvious? Fairly simply, to be honest. Henry Jackson and Jonathan Schenker are clearly well-meaning men who don't intend to shut women out. But it's Sergey Brin and the pregnancy parking all over again. Even the best of men can't know what it's like to go through the world as a person with a body which some other people treat as an access-all-areas amusement arcade. This just isn't something that Jackson and Schenker have to face on a regular basis, and therefore it really isn't all that surprising that they missed something so obvious. Male violence is far from the only issue keeping women out of VR. from the oversized headsets to research showing that VR causes motion sickness in women to a far larger degree than it does in men, to the fact that narrow computer displays favor men in tasks that require spatial awareness, you're left with another platform that just doesn't work well for women, and that is therefore likely to have fewer women on it. We don't know exactly why women are more likely to experience motion sickness while using VR, but Microsoft researcher Dana Boyd conducted a study that suggests a possible explanation. Human eyes use two basic cues to determine depth: motion parallax and shape from shading. Motion parallax refers to how an object seems bigger or smaller depending on how close you are to it, while shape from shading refers to the way the shading of a point changes as you move. And while 3D VR is pretty good at rendering motion parallax, it still does a terrible job of emulating shape from shading. This discrepancy creates sex differences in how well VR works because, as Boyd discovered, men are significantly more likely to rely on motion parallax for depth perception, while women rely on shape from shading. 3D environments are literally sending out information signals that benefit male over female depth perception. The question is, would we be so behind on recreating shape from shading if we had been testing 3D VR on equal numbers of men and women from the start? Tom Stoffregen, professor of kinesiology at the University of Minnesota, has an entirely different theory for why women experience more motion sickness than men. The classic theories, he says, are focused almost entirely on sensory stimulation. The idea is that what you feel in your inner ear doesn't match up with what you see with your eyes. And that's true, says Stoffregen, but it's not the only thing that changes. The big thing that traditional theories have not talked about, he says, is changes in what you need to do to control your body. In the normal course of your day, your body is constantly making micro adjustments in order to keep you stable. When you stand, when you sit, when you walk. But when you're in a moving environment, say a car or a ship, what you have to do to remain stable changes because your body is being destabilized. So, says Stoffregen, you are being physically required to move in a different way and you haven't learned how to do it yet. And like cars and ships, he says, VR destabilizes the body, hence the motion sickness. The VR industry has so far shown little interest in Stoffregen's research. They understand that it's a serious problem, but they're going the wrong way about fixing it, he says. The people who design VR think it's just an object that you put in front of your eyes, and the idea that it would have anything to do with anything other than your eyes is incoherent to them. But, he says, VR developers have to understand that they're doing more than simply placing screens in front of people's eyes, whether they like it or not, and whether they know it or not. VR developers also have to start collecting data systematically, and separating it by sex. Most of the data on motion sickness in VR are anecdotal, explains Stoffregen, and they come from the people who are working in these companies just using the systems themselves or trying them out at computer technology conferences or whatever. So they're completely unsystematic, and most of these people are men. One of the most convincing aspects of Stoffregen's theory is how it finally explains why I get car sick in every seat other than the driving seat. It's all about control. When you're walking, you are in control of your movements. You know what's coming. On a ship or in a car, someone else is in control, unless you're the driver. The driver knows what the motion of the car is going to be, and so the driver is able to stabilize his or herself in what we call an anticipatory fashion, explains Stoffregen, whereas the passenger cannot know in quantitative detail what the car is going to be doing. And so their control of their own body must be compensatory. And anticipatory control is just better than compensatory control. You know, that ain't no rocket science. But where does the sex difference come in? Everybody who studies motion sickness has known that women are more susceptible than men basically forever, says Stoffregen. It's just an utterly uncontroversial fact. It's just there. But, and he includes himself in this group, very few people did any research on it or made any effort to try and figure that out. Plus ça change. But in 2010, Stoffregen made a discovery. I was sort of fooling around in the literature and I came across some results that I didn't know about and which showed that there are sex differences in body sway. These are small, subtle differences. You can't just watch somebody and see them. But in terms of the subtle quantitative details of how the body moves back and forth, there are in fact reliable sex differences. And as soon as I saw this, I mean, I'm talking the minute I saw this, I knew that, oh, okay. Now I have something to say about the sex difference in motion sickness, because my whole story about motion sickness is that it's related to the control of the body. Since then, Stoffregen has also discovered evidence that women's postural sway changes across the menstrual cycle. And this is significant because a woman's susceptibility to motion sickness changes across the menstrual cycle. And those two things link up, believe it or not. A considerable gender data gap remains. We don't yet know exactly how and when women's body sway changes, but as a woman who suffers from extreme car sickness, I am excited and enraged by Stoffregen's findings, particularly because of how it ties into another gender data gap I've been looking into, car design. When you're sitting down, you're still swaying. If you're sitting on a stool, then you're swaying around your hips, explains Stoffregen. If your chair has a back, then your head is swaying on your neck. The only way to really get rid of that is to have a headrest and to use it, he adds. And I feel like one of those cartoon light bulbs has just gone off in my head. What if the headrest is at the wrong height, at the wrong angle, and the wrong shape to accommodate your body? Could women's increased propensity to motion sickness in cars be exacerbated by cars being designed around the male body, I ask? I think that's quite possible, sure, Stoffregen replies. The quality of the stabilization, if it's the wrong height or whatever, what you're telling me is new to me, but it sounds perfectly plausible. But here I run into yet another data gap. The available research on whether car headrests have been designed to account for the female body is seemingly non-existent. This gap is hardly unexpected, though. Car design has a long and ignominious history of ignoring women. Men are more likely than women to be involved in a car crash, which means they dominate the numbers of those seriously injured in car accidents. But when a woman is involved in a car crash, she is 47% more likely to be seriously injured than a man and 71% more likely to be moderately injured, even when researchers control for factors such as height, weight, seatbelt usage, and crash intensity. She is also 17% more likely to die. And it's all to do with how the car is designed and for whom. Women tend to sit further forward than men when driving. This is because we are on average shorter. Our legs need to be closer to reach the pedals, and we need to sit more upright to see clearly over the dashboard. This is not, however, the standard seating position. Women are out-of-position drivers, and our willful deviation from the norm means that we are at greater risk of internal injury on frontal collisions. The angle of our knees and hips as our shorter legs reach for the pedals also makes our legs more vulnerable. Essentially, we're doing it all wrong. Women are also at higher risk in rear-end collisions. Women have less muscle on our necks and upper torso than men, which makes us more vulnerable to whiplash by up to 3 times, and car design has amplified this vulnerability. Swedish research has shown that modern seats are too firm to protect women against whiplash injuries. The seats throw women forward faster than men because the back of the seat doesn't give way for women's, on average, lighter bodies. The reason this has been allowed to happen is very simple. Cars have been designed using car crash test dummies based on the average male. Crash test dummies were first introduced in the 1950s, and for decades they were based around the 50th percentile male. The most commonly used dummy is 1.77 meters tall and weighs 76 kilograms, significantly taller and heavier than an average woman. And the dummy also has male muscle mass proportions and a male spinal column. In the early 1980s, researchers argued for the inclusion of a 50th percentile female in regulatory tests, but this advice was ignored. It wasn't until 2011 that the US started using a female crash test dummy, although, as we'll see, just how female these dummies are is questionable. In 2018, Astrid Linder, Research Director of Traffic Safety at the Swedish National Road and Transport Research Institute, presented a paper at the Road Safety on Five Continents conference in South Korea, in which she ran through EU regulatory crash test requirements. In the EU, there are 5 tests a car must pass before being allowed on the market: 1 safety belt test, 2 frontal collision tests, and 2 lateral collision tests. In no test is an anthropometrically correct female crash test dummy required. The seatbelt test, 1 of the frontal collisions tests, and 2 lateral collision tests all specify that a 50th percentile male dummy should be used. When Linda looked at regulatory tests worldwide, she found that while there are several local differences, regulatory tests are still using the 50th percentile male to represent the whole adult population. There is one EU regulatory test that requires what is called a 5th percentile female dummy, which is meant to represent the female population. Only 5% of women will be shorter than this dummy. But there are a number of data gaps, For a start, this dummy is only tested in the passenger seat, so we have no data at all for how a female driver would be affected, something of an issue, you would think, given women's out-of-position driving position. And secondly, this female dummy is not really female. It is just a scaled-down male dummy. Consumer tests can be slightly more stringent. When I spoke to the Euro NCAP, a European organisation that provides car safety ratings for consumers, they informed me that since 2015, they have used male and female dummies in both front crash tests and that they do base their female dummies on female anthropometric data, with the caveat that this is where data is available. And that, says Linda, is quite the caveat. To my knowledge, little or even no such data is available, she tells me, adding that there is currently no way Euro NCAP can identify the protective systems that protect both males and females the best way. In any ways, Euro NCAP acknowledged that sometimes they do just use scaled-down male dummies. But as we'll cover extensively in the next chapter, women are not scaled-down men. We have different muscle mass distribution. We have lower bone density. There are sex differences in vertebrae spacing. As Stoffregen has noted, even our body sway is different. And these differences are all crucial when it comes to injury rates and car crashes. The situation is even worse for pregnant women. Although a pregnant crash test dummy was created back in 1996, testing with it is still not government mandated either in the US or in the EU. In fact, even though car crashes are the number one cause of fetal death related to maternal trauma, we haven't even yet developed a seatbelt that works for pregnant women. Research from 2004 suggests that pregnant women should use the standard seatbelt, but 62% of third trimester pregnant women don't fit the standard seatbelt design. A three-point seatbelt can also ride up on women who carry low, which a 1996 study found can treble or quadruple force transmission to the abdomen compared to when the belt is worn below the uterus, with a corresponding increased risk of fetal injury. Standard seatbelts aren't great for non-pregnant women either. Apparently, in an effort to accommodate our breasts, many of us are wearing seatbelts improperly, which again increases our risk of injury. Another reason we should be designing explicitly female dummies rather than just smaller male dummies. And it's not just a woman's belly that changes in pregnancy. Breast size changes can also diminish seatbelt efficacy by affecting positioning. Here again, we find an example of a situation where we have the data on women, but are just ignoring it. Clearly, what is needed is a wholesale redesign of cars using complete data. And this should be fairly simple, since it's not exactly hard to find women to model a test dummy on. Even with all these gaps, the 2011 introduction of the female crash test dummy in the US still sent cars' star ratings plummeting. The Washington Post reported on the experience of Beth Milito and her husband, who bought a 2011 Toyota Sienna based primarily on its four-star safety rating. But all was not as it seemed. The passenger seat, which Milito says she is likely to be sitting in when they are out and about as a family, had a two-star rating. In the previous year's model, the front passenger seat, tested on a male dummy, had earned a top five-star rating. But the shift to female dummies had revealed that in a front collision at 35 miles per hour, a female passenger had a 20 to 40% risk of being killed or seriously injured. The average risk of death for that class of vehicle, explains the Washington Post, is 15%. A 2015 report by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety is excitingly headlined, "Improved Vehicle Designs Bring Down Death Rates," which sounds great. Perhaps this is the result of the new legislation. Unlikely. Buried in the report is the following telltale line. The rates include only driver deaths because the presence of passengers is unknown. This is a huge gender data gap. When men and women are in a car together, the man is most likely to be driving. So not collecting data on passengers more or less translates as not collecting data on women. The infuriating irony of all this is that the gendered passenger-driver norm is so prevalent that, as we've seen, the passenger seat is the only seat that is commonly tested with a female crash test dummy anyway, with the male crash test dummy still being the standard dummy for the driver's seat. So stats that include only driver fatalities will tell us precisely zero about the impact of introducing the female crash test dummy. In conclusion, a more accurate headline for the report would be, "Improved vehicle design brings down death rates in the seat most likely to be occupied by men, but who knows about death rates in the seat most likely to be occupied by women, even though we already know women are 17% more likely to die in a car crash." Admittedly, this is less snappy. When I speak to Dr. David Lawrence, director of safety literature database, the Safety Lit Foundation, he tells me that in most US states, the quality of police crash reports is at best poor for use as a research tool. little data is gathered about anyone other than the driver. Written police reports have often been handed to contract companies for data entry, most of whom use prison labour for data entry. Data quality checks were rare, and when quality was evaluated, it was found wanting. For example, in Louisiana, for most crashes in the 1980s, most of the occupants were males who were born on January 1, 1950. Almost all of the vehicles involved in crashes were the 1960 model year, except they weren't. These were just the default settings. Lawrence tells me that even though this problem has been found in many other states, the data hasn't improved because no changes in the data entry practices were made. The federal government required that states provide police crash report data to NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, but set no standards for data quality nor penalty for sending junk data. Astrid Linder has been working on what she says will be the first crash test dummy to accurately represent female bodies. Currently, it's just a prototype, but she is calling on the EU to make testing on anthropometrically correct female crash test dummies a legal requirement. In fact, Linda argues that this technically already is a legal requirement. Article 8 of the legally binding Treaty of the Functioning of the European Union reads, "In all its activities, the Union shall aim to eliminate inequalities and to promote equality between men and women." Clearly, women being 47% more likely to be seriously injured in a car crash is one hell of an inequality to be overlooking. In some ways, it's hard to understand why a proper female crash test dummy hasn't been developed and made a legal requirement in car tests years ago. But on the other hand, and given all we know about how women and their bodies are routinely ignored in design and planning, it's not surprising at all. From development initiatives to smartphones, from medical tech to stoves, tools, whether physical or financial, are developed without reference to women's needs. And, as a result, these tools are failing them on a grand scale. And this failure affects women's lives on a similarly grand scale. It makes them poorer, it makes them sicker, and when it comes to cars, it is killing them. Designers may believe they are making products for everyone, but in reality, they are mainly making them for men. It's time to start designing women in. Part 4. Going to the doctor. Chapter 10. The drugs don't work. It took 12 years for Michelle to receive a diagnosis. I was about 14 when I first started having symptoms, she tells me. I was too ashamed to go to a doctor for it. She kept her urgent, painful, frequent, sometimes bloody bowel movements a secret for 2 years until one night it hurt too much to hide anymore. I couldn't move from the fetal position on my bathroom floor. I was afraid I was dying. She was 16. Michelle's parents rushed her to the emergency room. A doctor there asked her, in front of her parents, if she could be pregnant. No, she couldn't be, Michelle explained, because she hadn't had sex and in any case the pain was in her intestines. They wheeled me into an exam room and without any explanation placed my feet into stirrups. The next thing I knew, a large cold metal speculum was crammed into my vagina. It hurt so badly I sat up and screamed and the nurse had to push me back down and hold me there while the doctor confirmed that indeed I was not pregnant. She was discharged with nothing more than some overpriced aspirin and the advice to rest for a day. Over the next decade, Michelle sought help from two more doctors and two male gastroenterologists, both of whom told her that her problems were in her head and that she needed to be less anxious and stressed. At the age of 26, Michelle was referred to a female GP who scheduled her for a colonoscopy. It revealed that the entire left side of her colon was diseased. She was diagnosed with both irritable bowel syndrome and ulcerative colitis. Funnily enough, Michelle says, my colon is not in my head. As a result of the extended delay in receiving a diagnosis and treatment, she has been left with an increased risk of colon cancer. It's hard to read an account like this and not feel angry with the doctors who let Michelle down so badly. But the truth is that these are not isolated rogue doctors, bad apples who should be struck off. They are the products of a medical system which, from root to tip, is systematically discriminating against women, leaving them chronically misunderstood, mistreated, and misdiagnosed. It begins with how doctors are trained. Historically, it's been assumed that there wasn't anything fundamentally different between male and female bodies other than size and reproductive function. And so for years, medical education has been focused on a male norm, with everything that falls outside that designated atypical or even abnormal. References to the typical 70-kilogram man abound, as if he covers both sexes. As one doctor pointed out to me, he doesn't even represent men very well. When women are mentioned, they are presented as if they are a variation on standard humanity. Students learn about physiology and female physiology, anatomy and female anatomy. The male body, concluded social psychologist Carol Tavris in her 1992 book The Mismeasure of Woman, is anatomy itself. This male default bias goes back at least to the ancient Greeks, who kicked off the trend of seeing the female body as a mutilated male body. Thanks, Aristotle. The female was the male turned outside in. Ovaries were female testicles. They were not given their own name until the 17th century, and the uterus was the female scrotum. The reason they were inside the body rather than dropped out, as in typical humans, is because of a female deficiency in vital heat. The male body was an ideal women failed to live up to. Modern doctors, of course, no longer refer to women as mutilated males, but the representation of the male body as the human body persists. A 2008 analysis of a range of textbooks recommended by 20 of the most prestigious universities in Europe, the United States, and Canada revealed that across 16,329 images, male bodies were used three times as often as female bodies to illustrate neutral body parts. A 2008 study of textbooks recommended by Dutch medical schools found that sex-specific information was absent even in sections on topics where sex differences have long been established, such as depression and the effects of alcohol on the body. And results from clinical trials were presented as valid for men and women, even when women were excluded from the study. The few sex differences that did get a mention were hardly accessible via index or layout, and in any case tended to be vague one-liners such as women, who more often have atypical chest discomfort. As we'll see, only 1 in 8 women who have a heart attack report the classic male symptom of chest pain. So in fact, this description is arguably not only vague, but inaccurate. In 2017, I decided to see if much had changed and set off to a large bookshop in central London with a particularly impressive medical section. Things had not changed. The covers of books entitled Human Anatomy were still adorned with bemuscled men. Drawings of features common to both sexes continued to routinely include pointless penises. I found posters entitled Ear, Nose and Throat, The Nervous System, The Muscular System and The Vascular System and Viscera, all of which featured a large-scale drawing of a man. The vascular system poster did, however, include a small female pelvis off to one side, and me and my female pelvis were grateful for small mercies. The gender data gaps found in medical textbooks are also present in your typical medical school curriculum. A 2005 Dutch study found that sex and gender-related issues were not systematically addressed in curriculum development. A 2006 review of Kermit, the US online database for med school courses, found that only 9 out of the 95 schools that entered data into the system offered a course that could be described as a women's health course. Only 2 of these courses, obstetrics and gynecology classes taught in the 2nd or 3rd academic years, were mandatory. Even conditions that are known to cause the greatest morbidity and mortality in women failed to incorporate sex-specific information. 10 years later, another review found that the integration of sex and gender-based medicine in US med schools remained minimal and haphazard, with gaps particularly identified in the approach to the treatment of disease and use of drugs. These gaps matter because, contrary to what we've assumed for millennia, sex differences can be substantial. Researchers have found sex differences in every tissue and organ system in the human body, as well as in the prevalence, course, and severity of the majority of common human diseases. There are sex differences in the fundamental mechanical workings of the heart. There are sex differences in lung capacity, even when these values are normalized to height. Perhaps related is the fact that among men and women who smoke the same number of cigarettes, women are 20 to 70% more likely to develop lung cancer. Autoimmune diseases affect about 8% of the population, but women are 3 times more likely to develop one, making up about 80% of those affected. We don't fully know why, but researchers think it might be down to women being the childbearing sex. The theory is that females evolved a particularly fast and strong immune response to protect developing fetuses and newborn babies, meaning that sometimes it overreacts and attacks the body. The immune system is also thought to be behind sex-specific responses to vaccines. Women develop higher antibody responses and have more frequent and severe adverse reactions to vaccines. And a 2014 paper proposed developing male and female versions of influenza vaccines. Sex differences appear even in our cells, in blood serum biomarkers for autism, in proteins, in immune cells used to convey pain signals, in how cells die following a stroke. A recent study also found a significant sex difference in the expression of a gene found to be important for drug metabolism. Sex differences in the presentation and outcome of Parkinson's disease, stroke, and brain ischemia insufficient blood flow to the brain, have also been tracked all the way to our cells, and there is growing evidence of a sex difference in the aging of the blood vessels, with inevitable implications for health problems, examination, and treatment. In a 2013 Nature article, Dr. Elizabeth Politzer points to research showing that male and female mice cells have been found to respond differently to stress, that male and female human cells exhibit wildly different concentrations of many metabolites, and to mounting evidence that cells differ according to sex, irrespective of their history of exposure to sex hormones. There are still vast medical gender data gaps to be filled in, but the past 20 years have demonstrably proven that women are not just smaller men. Male and female bodies differ down to a cellular level. So why aren't we teaching this? The inclusion of sex-specific information in textbooks is dependent on the availability of sex-specific data. But because women have largely been excluded from medical research, this data is severely lacking. Even the very basics of sex determination have a sex data gap. Since the landmark 1990 paper that identified the Y chromosome as the sex-determining region, the female sex has, the irony, been seen as the default. But in this case, the default didn't mean we focused on the female. Rather, research instead focused on testes development as the supposedly active process, while female sexual development was seen as a passive process. Until 2010, when we finally started researching the active process of ovarian determination. Most early research into cardiovascular disease was conducted on men, and women continue to be underrepresented, making up only 25% of participants across 31 landmark trials for congestive heart failure between 1987 and 2012. Women represent 55% of HIV-positive adults in the developing world, and in parts of Africa and the Caribbean, women aged 5 to 24 are up to 6 times more likely to be HIV-positive than young men of the same age. We also know that women experience different clinical symptoms and complications due to HIV, and yet a 2016 review of the inclusion of women in US HIV research found that women made up only 19.2% of participants in antiretroviral studies, 38.1% in vaccination studies, and 11.1% in studies to find a cure. Because of their routine exclusion from clinical trials, we lack solid data on how to treat pregnant women for pretty much anything. We may not know how a disease will take hold or what the likely outcome may be, although the WHO warns that many diseases can have particularly serious consequences for pregnant women or can harm the fetus. Some strains of influenza virus, including the 2009 H1N1 swine flu virus, have particularly severe symptoms during pregnancy. There is also evidence that SARS can be more severe during pregnancy. It is, of course, understandable that a pregnant woman may be reluctant to take part in medical research, but this doesn't mean that we have to just throw our hands up in the air and accept that we know nothing. We should be routinely and systematically tracking, recording, and collating pregnant women's health outcomes. But we aren't. Not even during pandemics. During the 2002-04 SARS outbreak in China, pregnant women's health outcomes were not systematically tracked. And consequently, the WHO points out, it was not possible to fully characterize the course and outcome of SARS during pregnancy. Another gender data gap that could have been so easily avoided, and information that will be lacking for when the next pandemic hits. Like the failure to include women in anatomy textbooks, the failure to include women in medical trials is a historical problem that has its roots in seeing the male body as the default human body. But this traditional bias was radically enhanced in the 1970s to the great detriment of women's health, following one of the biggest medical scandals of the 20th century. In 1960, doctors began prescribing thalidomide to pregnant women who suffered from morning sickness. The drug, which had been available as a mild over-the-counter sedative in many countries since the late 1950s, was considered safe because its developers could not find a dose high enough to kill a rat. But while it didn't kill rats, it did affect fetal development, something that in fact the manufacturers knew as early as 1959. Before the drug was taken off the market in 1962, over 10,000 children had been born around the world with thalidomide-related disabilities. In the wake of the scandal, the US Food and Drug Administration, FDA, issued guidelines in 1977 excluding women of childbearing potential from drug trials. This exclusion went unquestioned. The acceptance of the male norm went unquestioned. The male norm continues to go unquestioned by many today, with some researchers continuing to insist, in the face of all the evidence, that biological sex doesn't matter. One public health researcher revealed that she had received the following feedback on 2 different grant applications. I wish you'd stop with all this sex stuff and get back to science. And I've been in this field for 20 years, and this, biological difference, doesn't matter. It isn't just anonymous notes, either. A 2014 op-ed published in the journal Scientific American complained that including both sexes in experiments was a waste of resources. In 2015, an op-ed in the official scientific journal of the US National Academy of Sciences insisted that focusing on preclinical sex differences will not address women's and men's health disparities. Alongside insisting that sex differences don't matter, some researchers advocate against the inclusion of women in research on the basis that, while biological sex may matter, the lack of comparable data arising from the historical data gap makes including women inadvisable. Talk about adding insult to injury. Female bodies, both the human and animal variety, are, it is argued, too complex, too variable, too costly to be tested on. Integrating sex and gender into research is seen as burdensome. It is seen as possible for there to be too much gender and for its exclusion to be acceptable on the basis of simplification. In which case, it's worth noting that recent studies on mice have actually shown greater variability in males on a number of markers. So, who's too complicated now? Beyond the argument that women's bodies, with their fluctuating atypical hormones, are simply inconvenient research vessels, researchers also defend their failure to include women in trials by claiming that women are harder to recruit. And it is certainly true that, due to women's caregiving responsibilities, they have less leisure time and may find it harder to make, for example, clinic appointments during the school run. However, this is an argument for adapting trial schedules to women rather than simply excluding them. And in any case, it is possible to find women if you really want to. While reviews of FDA-mandated medical product trials found that women made up only 18% of participants in trials for endovascular occlusion devices, used if your fetal blood vessel hasn't closed of its own accord, and 32% of participants in studies in coronary stents, which incidentally are another device where women have worse outcomes than men, women represented 90% and 92% of participants in facial wrinkle correction trials and dental device trials, respectively. A more novel approach to addressing the problem of female underrepresentation in medical research is simply to claim that there is no problem and women are represented just fine, thank you very much. In February 2018, a paper was published in the British Journal of Pharmacology entitled Gender Differences in Clinical Registration Trials. Is there a real problem? Following cross-sectional structured research into publicly available registration dossiers of Food and Drug Administration, FDA, approved drugs that are prescribed frequently, the all-male authored paper concluded that no, the problem was not real. Leaving aside any philosophical debate over what an unreal problem might be, the authors' conclusions are baffling. For a start, data was available for only 28% of the drug trials, so we have no way of knowing how representative the sample is. In the data researchers were able to access, the number of female participants in over a quarter of trials did not match the proportion of women in the US affected by the disease the drug was supposed to treat. Furthermore, the study did not address trials for generic drugs, which represent 80% of prescriptions in the United States. The FDA describes a generic drug as a medication created to be the same as an already marketed brand name drug, and they are sold after the patent for the original branded drug runs out. Drugs trials for generic drugs are much less rigorous than original trials, having only to demonstrate equal bioavailability, and they are conducted almost exclusively in young adult males. This matters because even with the same active ingredient, different inactive ingredients and different fabrication technology can affect a drug's potency. And sure enough, in 2002, the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research showed statistically significant differences between men and women in bioequivalence for most generic drugs compared with reference drugs. Despite all this, the authors claimed that there was no evidence of any systematic underrepresentation of women in clinical trials, because in phase 2 and 3 trials, women were included at 48% and 49% respectively. But the study authors themselves report that in phase 1 trials, women represented only 22% of participants. And contrary to what their conclusion might imply, the underrepresentation of women in phase 1 trials does matter. According to the FDA, the second most common adverse drug reaction in women is that the drug simply doesn't work, even though it clearly works in men. So with that substantial sex difference in mind, how many drugs that would work for women are we ruling out at phase 1 trials just because they don't work in men? Digging deeper into the numbers, another issue the authors completely failed to address is whether or not the drugs were tested in women at different stages in their menstrual cycles. The likelihood is that they weren't, because most drugs aren't. When women are included in trials at all, they tend to be tested in the early follicular phase of their menstrual cycle, when hormone levels are at their lowest, i.e. when they are superficially most like men. The idea is to minimise the possible impacts estradiol and progesterone may have on the study outcomes. But real life isn't a study, and in real life, those pesky hormones will be having an impact on outcomes. So far, menstrual cycle impacts have been found for antipsychotics, antihistamines, and antibiotic treatments, as well as heart medication. Some antidepressants have been found to affect women differently at different times of their cycle, meaning that dosage may be too high at some points and too low at others. Women are also more likely to experience drug-induced heart rhythm abnormalities, and the risk is highest during the first half of a woman's cycle. This can, of course, be fatal. Finally, the authors didn't consider the number of drug treatments that might be beneficial to women, but never even reach human testing because they were ruled out at the cell and animal trial stage, and this number could be substantial. Sex differences in animals have been consistently reported for nearly 50 years, and yet a 2007 paper found that 90% of pharmacological articles described male-only studies. In 2014, another paper found that 22% of animal studies did not specify sex, and of those that did, 80% included only males. Perhaps most galling from a gender data gap perspective was the finding that females aren't even included in animal studies on female prevalent diseases. Women are 70% more likely to suffer depression than men, for instance, but animal studies on brain disorders are 5 times as likely to be done on male animals. A 2014 paper found that of studies on female prevalent diseases that specified sex, 44%, only 12% studied female animals. Even when both sexes are included, there is no guarantee the data will be sex analysed. One paper reported that in studies where two sexes were included, 2/3 of the time the results were not analysed by sex. Does this matter? Well, in the 2007 analysis of animal studies, of the few studies that did involve rats or mice of both sexes, 54% revealed sex-dependent drug effects. These sex-dependent effects can be extreme. Dr. Tammy Martino researches the impact of circadian rhythms on heart disease, and during a 2016 lecture to the Physiology Society, she recounted a recent shock discovery. Together with her team, she conducted a study which found that the time of day you have a heart attack affects your chances of survival. A heart attack that hits during the day triggers, among other things, a greater immune response. In particular, it triggers a greater neutrophil response. Neutrophils are a type of white blood cell that are usually first on the scene in response to any injury. And this response correlates with a better chance of survival. This finding has been replicated many times, over many years, with many different animals, becoming, explained Martino, the gold standard for survivorship in the literature. So Martino and her team were quite surprised when in 2016, another group of researchers released a paper which also found that daytime heart attacks triggered a greater neutrophil response, but that this correlated with a worse chance of survival. After a substantial amount of head-scratching, they realised there was one basic difference between the historic studies and this one new study. The old studies had all used male mice, while this new paper had used female mice. Different sex, totally opposite result. As for cell studies, a 2011 review of 10 cardiovascular journals found that when sex was specified, 69% of cell studies reported using only male cells. And when sex was specified is an important caveat. A 2007 analysis of 645 cardiovascular clinical trials, all published in prominent journals, found that only 24% provided sex-specific results. A 2014 analysis of 5 leading surgical journals found that 76% of cell studies did not specify sex, and of those that did, 71% included only male cells, and only 7% reported sex-based results. And again, even for diseases that are more prevalent in women, researchers can be found exclusively studying XY cells. As in animal and human studies, when sex has been analysed in cell studies, dramatic differences have been found. For years, researchers were puzzled by the unpredictability of transplanted, muscle-derived stem cells. Sometimes they regenerated diseased muscle, sometimes they didn't do anything, until they realised that the cells weren't unpredictable at all. It's just that female cells promote regeneration and male cells don't. Perhaps of more urgent concern for women's health is the 2016 discovery of a sex difference in how male and female cells respond to estrogen. When researchers exposed male and female cells to this hormone and then infected them with a virus, only the female cells responded to the estrogen and fought off the virus. It's a tantalizing finding that inevitably leads to the following question. How many treatments have women missed out on because they had no effect on the male cells on which they were exclusively tested? In light of all this evidence, it's hard to see how researchers can continue to argue in good faith that sex doesn't matter. Rather, it seems clear that McGill University neuroscientist Jeffrey Mogul was right when he told the Organization for the Study of Sex Differences that failing to include both sexes right at the very beginning of your research is not only scientifically idiotic and a waste of money, it is an ethical issue as well. Nevertheless, women continue to be routinely underrepresented in medical research, and you can't even expect sex-specific trials to adequately represent women. When the female Viagra that was released with much fanfare in 2015 was found to potentially interact negatively with alcohol, as most listeners will know, the absorption of alcohol differs between men and women. Its manufacturer, Sprout Pharmaceuticals, quite rightly decided to run a trial, for which they recruited 23 men and 2 women. They did not sex disaggregate the data. In this latter failure, they are not alone. Several reviews of papers published in major journals over the past 10 years have all identified a routine failure to either present results by sex or to explain why the influence of sex has been ignored. A 2001 US Government Accounting Office, GAO, audit of FDA records found that about a third of documents didn't sex disaggregate their outcomes, and 40% didn't even specify the sex of the participants. The auditors concluded that the FDA had not effectively overseen the presentation and analysis of data related to sex differences in drug development, a finding that was confirmed in a 2007 analysis of new drug applications submitted to the FDA, which found a failure to establish standards for data analysis of applications. In 2015, the GAO criticized the US National Institutes of Health, NIH, for failing to routinely track whether researchers had actually evaluated any differences between the sexes. Things are often even worse in non-government funded trials, which represent the majority of studies. A 2014 investigation into sex analysis in cardiovascular trials found that 31 of 61 NIH-sponsored trials analysed outcomes by sex, compared with only 125 of 567 non-NIH-sponsored clinical trials. The lack of sex disaggregated data affects our ability to give women sound medical advice. In 2011, the World Cancer Research Fund complained that only 50% of studies into the impact of diet on cancer that included both men and women disaggregated their data by sex, making it hard to establish dietary guidelines for cancer prevention that are valid for both sexes. Women, for example, should probably eat more protein than men as they age because of muscle mass loss, but the optimal dose per meal to support muscle protein synthesis in older women has not been determined. The failure to sex disaggregate when you've actually gone to the effort of including both sexes is baffling, not to mention, as Londa Scheibinger at Stanford University puts it, money wasted and research that is lost to future meta-analysis. And when female representation in trials is so low, the ability to conduct meta-analysis can mean the difference between life and death. In 2014, a review of the FDA database of a cardiac resynchronization therapy device, CRTD, essentially a more complicated kind of pacemaker, trials found that women made up about 20% of participants. The number of women included in each individual study was so low that separating out the data for men and women didn't reveal anything statistically significant. But when the review authors combined all the trial results and sex disaggregated that data, they found something alarming. A CRTD is used to correct a delay in your heart's electrical signals. They are implanted for established heart failure, and the D stands for defibrillator. This defibrillator, a larger version of which most of us will have seen in one hospital drama or other, performs something like a hard reset on the heart, shocking it out of its irregular rhythm so that it can restart in its correct rhythm. A doctor I spoke to described CRTDs as symptom control. They aren't a cure, but they prevent many early deaths. And if your heart takes 150 milliseconds or longer to complete a full electrical wave, you should have one implanted. If your heart completes a full circuit in under that time, you wouldn't benefit from one. Unless, the meta-analysis found, you happen to be female. While the 150 milliseconds threshold worked for men, it was 20 milliseconds too high for women. This may not sound like much, but the meta-analysis found that women with an electrical wave of between 130 to 49 milliseconds had a 76% reduction in heart failure or death, and a 76% reduction in death alone from having the advanced pacemaker implanted. But these women would not be given the device under the guidelines, and so, because the trials treated male bodies as the default and women as a sideshow, they had condemned hundreds of women to avoidable heart failure and death. The CRTD is far from the only piece of medical tech that doesn't work for women, which is unsurprising given a 2014 analysis which found that only 14% of post-approval medical device studies included sex as a key outcome measure, and only 4% included a subgroup analysis for female participants. A 2010 paper found that the female gender is associated with an increased risk of acute complications during primary pacemaker implantation, being independent from age or type of device implanted. In 2013, a supposedly revolutionary artificial heart was developed that was too big for women. Its designers are working on a smaller version, which is great, but it's striking that, like other artificial hearts, the female version comes years after the default male one. Even something as basic as advice on how to exercise to keep disease at bay is based on male-biased research. If you run a general search for whether resistance training is good for reducing heart disease, you'll come across a series of papers warning against resistance training if you have high blood pressure. This is in large part because of the concerns that it doesn't have as beneficial an effect on lowering blood pressure as aerobic exercise, and also because it causes an increase in artery stiffness. Which is all true. In men, who, as ever, form the majority of research participants. The research that has been done on women suggests that this advice is not gender neutral. A 2008 paper, for example, found that not only does resistance training lower blood pressure to a greater extent in women, women don't suffer from the same increase in artery stiffness. And this matters because as women get older, their blood pressure gets higher compared to men of the same age, and elevated blood pressure is more directly linked to cardiovascular mortality in women than in men. In fact, the risk of death from coronary artery disease for women is twice that for men for every 20 millimeters of mercury increase in blood pressure above normal levels. It also matters because commonly used antihypertensive drugs have been shown to be less beneficial in lowering blood pressure in women than in men. So to sum up, for women, the blood pressure drugs developed using male subjects don't work as effectively, but resistance training just might do the trick. Except we haven't known that because all the studies have been done on men. And this is before we account for the benefits to women in doing resistance training to counteract osteopenia and osteoporosis, both of which they are at high risk for post-menopause. Other male bias advice includes the recommendation for diabetics to do high-intensity interval training. It doesn't really help female diabetics. We don't really know why, but this is possibly because women burn fat more than carbs during exercise. We know very little about how women respond to concussions, even though women suffer from concussions at higher rates than men and take longer to recover in comparable sports. Isometric exercises fatigue women less, which is relevant for post-injury rehabilitation, because men and women have different ratios of types of muscle fiber. But we have a limited understanding of the differences because there are an inadequate number of published studies. When even something as simple as ice pack application is sex sensitive, it's clear that women should be included in sports medicine research at the same rates as men, but they aren't. And researchers continue to research men and act as if their findings apply to women. In 2017, a Loughborough University study was hailed around the UK news media as proving that a hot bath has anti-inflammatory and blood sugar response benefits similar to exercise. Published in the journal Temperature with the subheading, A Possible Treatment for Metabolic Diseases, the study included no women at all. We know that men and women have different metabolic systems. We know that diabetes, one of the diseases particularly singled out as being relevant to this discovery, also affects men and women differently, and that it is a greater risk factor for cardiovascular disease in women than in men. But despite all this, the paper's authors consistently failed to acknowledge any relevance of sex differences to their research. They cited animal studies that had similarly been conducted in all-male populations, and perhaps most shockingly of all, in a section specifically looking at limitations with the present investigation, they completely failed to mention the fact that the study was all-male as a potential drawback, only referring to their relatively small sample size. There have been some attempts to force researchers to properly represent females in medical research. Since 1993, when the US passed the National Institute of Health Revitalization Act, it has been illegal not to include women in federally funded clinical trials. Australia's main funding body made similar rules for the research it funds, as has the EU, which in fact went even further, also requiring both sexes to be studied in preclinical animal studies. This requirement did not come into effect in the US until January 2016, which is also when the NIH introduced the requirement that the data and trials it funded be disaggregated and analysed by sex, unless there is a compelling reason not to. Other positive developments include the German Society of Epidemiology, which has for more than a decade required researchers to justify including only one sex in any study where the results could potentially affect both sexes, and the introduction of the same by the Canadian Institutes of Health in 2012, as well as mandatory questions about the consideration of sex and gender in the study design. Some academic journals also now insist that papers submitted for publication should provide information about the gender of participants in clinical trials, for example. Trailing behind everyone is the UK, whose main funders make no substantive reference to or requirements regarding the consideration of gender in research design and analysis. And despite the at-risk population of women suffering more morbidity and mortality, UK research funding for coronary artery disease in men is far greater than for women. Indeed, such is the dearth of gender-based clinical research from within the UK that Anita Holdcroft, Emeritus Professor at Imperial College London, has written that for cardiovascular treatment, it is pertinent to use studies from North America and Europe where these issues have been investigated. Still, while the situation in the UK is dire, significant problems remain elsewhere. For a start, the evidence we've just seen on the representation of women in trials suggests that these policies are not being rigorously enforced. And indeed, this is what analyses of the NIH have found. 4 years after the NIH announced their first policy calling for the inclusion of women in medical trials, a report was released by the GAO which criticised the NIH for having no readily accessible source of data on the demographics of NIH study populations, making it impossible to determine if the NIH was enforcing its own recommendations. By 2015, the GAO was still reporting that the NIH does a poor job of enforcing rules requiring that clinical trials include both sexes. There also remain plenty of loopholes for US drug manufacturers who don't want the cost and complication of including unharmonious females with their messy hormones in their neat clinical trials, because the rules only apply to NIH-funded trials. Independent drug manufacturers can do whatever they want, and the evidence suggests that many of them do. A 2016 paper found that a quarter of the drug manufacturers in an industry survey did not deliberately recruit representative numbers of women as participants in drug trials. When it comes to generic drugs, the FDA only specifies guidelines rather than rules, and as we've seen, these guidelines are being roundly ignored. And the NIH policy on including female subjects in clinical trials doesn't apply to cell studies. Then, of course, there's the issue of legacy drugs. 2 million women per year take Valium for conditions ranging from anxiety to epilepsy, and it was aggressively marketed towards women for decades. And yet, a 2003 paper points out this mother's little helper was never tested in randomized clinical trials with female subjects. A 1992 survey by the US General Accounting Office, the congressional watchdog, found that less than half of publicly available prescription drugs had been analyzed for sex differences. A 2015 Dutch paper boldly states that the specific effect on women of a huge number of existing medications is simply unknown. There is clearly a long way to go, and we must begin to address these gaps as a matter of urgency, because while they remain open, women, who ingest approximately 80% of pharmaceuticals in the US, are dying. Some drugs used to break up blood clots immediately after a heart attack can cause significant bleeding problems in women. Other drugs that are commonly prescribed to treat high blood pressure have been found to lower men's mortality from heart attack, but to increase cardiac-related deaths among women. Statins, which are regularly prescribed around the world as a preventative measure for heart disease, have mainly been tested in men, and recent research from Australia suggests that women taking statins at higher dosages may face an increased diabetes risk, which in turn is a higher risk factor for cardiovascular disease in women than in men. In 2000, the FDA forced drug manufacturers to remove phenylpropanolamine, a component of many over-the-counter medications, from all products because of a reported increased risk of bleeding into the brain or into tissue around the brain in women, but not in men. Drug-induced acute liver failure has also been reported more often in women, and certain HIV medications are 6 to 8 times more likely to cause an adverse drug reaction, ADR, in women. In 2014, the FDA released a database of ADR reports between 2004 and 2013, which showed that women are far more likely than men to experience an ADR. More than 2 million were recorded for women, compared to less than 1.3 million for men. Although around the same numbers of men and women die from an ADR, death is ninth on the list of most common ADRs for women, compared to first on the list for men. The second most common ADR for women, after nausea, is that the drug simply doesn't work at all. And data on the number of deaths that occur as a result of the drug failing to work is not available. We do know, however, that women are more likely to be hospitalized following an ADR and more likely to experience more than one. A 2001 US study found that 80% of drugs that had been recently removed from the market caused more ADRs in women, while a 2017 analysis points to the large number of medications and medical devices removed from the market by the FDA that posed greater health risks to women. None of this should surprise us, because despite obvious sex differences, the vast majority of drugs, including anesthetics and chemotherapeutics, continue with gender-neutral dosages, which puts women at risk of overdose. At a most basic level, women tend to have a higher body fat percentage than men, which, along with the fact that blood flow to fat tissue is greater in women, for men it's greater to skeletal muscle, can affect how they metabolize certain drugs. Acetaminophen, an ingredient in many pain relievers, for example, is eliminated by the female body at approximately 60% of the rate documented in men. Sex differences in drug metabolism is in part because women's lower lean body mass results in a lower base metabolic rate, but it can also be affected by, among other things, sex differences in kidney enzymes, in bile acid composition, women have less, and intestinal enzyme activity. Male gut transit times are also around half the length of women's, meaning women may need to wait for longer after eating before taking medications that must be absorbed on an empty stomach. Kidney filtering is also faster in men, meaning some renally excreted medications, for example digoxin, a heart medication, may require a dosage adjustment. For millennia, medicine has functioned on the assumption that male bodies can represent humanity as a whole. As a result, we have a huge historical data gap when it comes to female bodies, and this is a data gap that is continuing to grow as researchers carry on ignoring the pressing ethical need to include female cells, animals, and humans in their research. That this is still going on in the 21st century is a scandal. It should be the subject of newspaper headlines worldwide. Women are dying, and the medical world is complicit. It needs to wake up. Chapter 11. Yentl Syndrome. In the 1983 film Yentl, Barbara Streisand plays a young Jewish woman in Poland who pretends to be a man in order to receive an education. The film's premise has made its way into medical lore as Yentl Syndrome, which describes the phenomenon whereby women are misdiagnosed and poorly treated unless their symptoms or diseases conform to that of men. Sometimes, Yentl syndrome can prove fatal. If I were to ask you to picture someone in the throes of a heart attack, you most likely would think of a man in his late middle age, possibly overweight, clutching at his heart in agony. That's certainly what a Google image search offers up. You're unlikely to think of a woman. Heart disease is a male thing. But this stereotype is misleading. A recent analysis of data from 22 million people from North America, Europe, Asia, and Australasia found that women from lower socioeconomic backgrounds are 25% more likely to suffer a heart attack than men in the same income bracket. Since 1989, cardiovascular disease has been the leading cause of death in US women, and following a heart attack, women are more likely to die than men. This disparity in deaths has been the case since 1984, and young women appear to be particularly at risk. In 2016, the British Medical Journal reported that young women were almost twice as likely as men to die in hospital. This may be in part because doctors aren't spotting at-risk women. In 2016, the American Heart Association also raised concerns about a number of risk prediction models commonly used in patients with acute coronary syndrome, because they were developed in patient populations that were at least two-thirds male. The performance of these risk prediction models in women is not well established. Common preventative methods may also not work as well in women. Acetyl salicylic acid, aspirin, has been found to be effective in preventing a first heart attack in men, but a 2005 paper found that it had a non-significant effect in women aged between 45 and 65. Prior to this study, the authors noted, there had been few similar data in women. A more recent study from 2011 found that not only was aspirin ineffective for women, it was potentially harmful in the majority of patients. Similarly, a 2015 study found that taking a low dose of aspirin every other day is ineffective or harmful in the majority of women in primary prevention of cancer or heart disease. Perhaps the greatest contributor to the numbers of women dying following a heart attack, however, is that their heart attacks are simply being missed by their doctors. Research from the UK has found that women are 50% more likely to be misdiagnosed following a heart attack, rising to almost 60% for some types of heart attack. This is partly because women often don't have the Hollywood heart attack, as it's known in medical circles, chest and left arm pains. Women, particularly young women, may in fact present without any chest pain at all, but rather with stomach pain, breathlessness, nausea, and fatigue. These symptoms are often referred to as atypical, a designation to which the British Medical Journal took exception in a 2016 article, saying that the term may lead to the underappreciation of risk associated with this presentation. And underappreciation of the risk may in turn explain why a 2005 US study found that only 1 in 5 physicians across multiple specialities was aware that more women than men die from cardiovascular disease each year, and most of these physicians did not rate themselves as effective in treating sex-tailored cardiovascular disease. Atypical or not, for certain types of heart attacks, women, and again especially young women, who present without chest pain are at particular risk of death, which makes it extremely concerning that current NHS England guidelines specify acute cardiac-sounding chest pain as part of the criteria for a patient being referred for primary percutaneous coronary interventions, PPCI, at one of the country's specialist 24-hour heart attack centres. PPCI is an emergency treatment that restores blood flow during a heart attack, and which, according to one doctor I spoke to, has massively improved survival and outcome. But this treatment is only carried out at the 24-hour heart attack centres, and perhaps as a result, 75% of those who receive this treatment are men. The tests doctors use to determine what's wrong with a patient are also likely contributing to women's higher death rates following a heart attack. Standard tests like the electrocardiogram or the physical stress test have been found to be less conclusive in women. A 2016 BMJ paper refers to recent work from Edinburgh, which showed that the normal diagnostic threshold for troponin, a protein released into the blood during heart damage, may be too high for women. And it's not just about standard levels for biomarkers being incorrect in women. We also need to establish new female-specific biomarkers. A biomarker is a biological characteristic, like troponin, whose presence can act as a diagnostic criteria for a specific disease. And a 2014 literature review of sex difference studies suggests that this may be a fruitful area to research. Unfortunately, it concludes that the work done so far is too limited to be able to say whether or not female-specific biomarkers will be found. But because women's heart attacks may not only present differently, but may in fact be mechanically different, the technology we've developed to search for problems may not be suitable for female hearts. For example, a heart attack is traditionally diagnosed with an angiogram, which will show where there are obstructed arteries. But women often don't have obstructed arteries, meaning that the scan won't show up any abnormalities, and women who turn up at hospital with angina, chest pain, may simply be discharged with a diagnosis of non-specific chest pain and told they have no significant disease. Except they do. Women with normal angiograms have gone on to suffer a heart attack or stroke shortly after being discharged from hospital. Assuming a woman gets lucky and has her heart disease diagnosed, she must then navigate the obstacle course of male-biased treatment. Sex differences have not generally been integrated either into received medical wisdom or even clinical guidelines. For example, say a man and a woman are both diagnosed with a swollen aorta. The aorta is the main blood vessel that runs from the heart down through the chest and stomach. They are both suffering from an equal level of swelling, but their risk is not the same. The woman has a higher risk of rupture, which carries with it a 65% chance of death, and yet, in Dutch clinical guidelines, the thresholds for surgery don't differ for each sex. Diagnostic tests developed around male bodies are also a problem in other medical disciplines, even those where women are more at risk. Women have a higher risk than men of developing right-sided colon cancer, which often develops more aggressively, but the fecal blood test commonly used to detect colon cancer is less sensitive in women than in men. Meanwhile, because women have, on average, a longer and narrower colon than men, colonoscopies in women may be incomplete. Then there's what the WHO calls the frequent mistake of underestimating the importance of symptoms that can only occur in one sex, such as vaginal bleeding and dengue fever. When symptoms are listed in order of frequency for all patients, rather than separated by sex, female-specific symptoms can be presented as less significant than they are in reality. The impact of such data gaps can snowball. When it comes to tuberculosis, TB, for example, a failure to account for how female social roles could make the disease more dangerous for women combines with a failure to collect sex-disaggregated data, leading to potentially deadly consequences. Men are more likely to have latent TB, but women are more likely to develop the active disease. Studies also suggest that women in developing countries who cook in poorly ventilated rooms with biomass fuels, as we've seen, this means millions of women, have impaired immune systems, which leave them less able to fight off the bacteria. The result is that TB kills more women globally than any other single infectious disease. More women die annually of TB than of all causes of maternal mortality combined, but TB is nevertheless often considered to be a male disease, and as a result, women are less likely to be screened for it. Even when women are screened, they are less likely to be diagnosed. Women may have a different immune response to TB, resulting in different symptoms, and one study on why women are misdiagnosed found that TB lung lesions might not appear as severe in women. There is also evidence of sex differences in the sensitivity of commonly used screening tests. The standard way to test for TB in resource-limited settings is to get patients to cough up sputum and examine it under the microscope. But women with TB are less likely to have a sputum-producing cough, and even if they do have one, their sputum is less likely to test positive for the disease. The sputum test is also problematic for social reasons. A study in Pakistan reported that women felt uncomfortable coughing up the mucus needed for the examination, and health workers weren't explaining why they needed to, so they didn't. Medical practice that doesn't account for female socialization is a widespread issue in preventative efforts as well. The traditional advice of using condoms to avoid HIV infection is simply not practicable for many women who lack the social power to insist on their use. This also goes for Ebola, which can remain present in semen for up to 6 months. And although a gel has been developed to address this problem, it fails to account for the practice of dry sex in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa. A gel which also acts as a lubricant will not be acceptable in areas where women de-lubricate their vaginas with herbs in order to indicate that they are chaste. Failing to account for female socialization can also lead to women living for decades with undiagnosed behavioral disorders. For years, we have thought that autism is 4 times more common in boys than in girls, and that when girls have it, they are more seriously affected. But new research suggests that in fact female socialization may help girls mask their symptoms better than boys, and that there are far more girls living with autism than we previously realized. This historical failure is partly a result of the criteria for diagnosing autism having been based on data derived almost entirely from studies of boys, with a 2016 Maltese study concluding that a significant cause of misdiagnosis in girls was a general male bias in diagnostic methods and clinical expectations. There is also emerging evidence that some girls with anorexia may in fact be suffering from autism, but because it's not a typical male symptom, it's been missed. Sarah Wilde, head of Limpsfield Grange, the UK's only state-funded residential school for girls with special needs, told The Guardian that the diagnostic checklists and tests have been developed for boys and men, while girls and women present completely differently. Meanwhile, a recently published draft of the new NHS guidance on autism made no mention of women's differing needs. There are similar diagnostic problems when it comes to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and Asperger's. A 2012 survey by the UK's National Autistic Society found that just 8% of girls with Asperger's syndrome were diagnosed before the age of 6, compared with 25% of boys. By the age of 11, the figures were 21% and 52%, respectively. Up to 3/4 of girls with ADHD are estimated to be undiagnosed, a gap which Dr. Ellen Littman, the author of Understanding Girls with ADHD, puts down to the early clinical studies of ADHD having been done on really hyperactive young white boys. Girls tend to present less as hyperactive and more as disorganized, scattered, and introverted. More broadly, researchers suggest that because women are socialized to take turns in conversation, to downplay their own status, and to demonstrate behaviors that communicate more accessibility and friendliness, the traditional medical interview model may be unsuccessful in getting the information from women that is needed to diagnose them effectively. But sometimes, often, women are providing the information. It's just that they aren't being believed. American news website Think Progress reported the story of Kathy, whose heavy periods left her feeling so faint she couldn't stand. But when it came to getting a diagnosis, Kathy faced the same problem encountered by Michelle in the previous chapter. 4 different medical professionals thought it was in her head, that she was simply struggling with anxiety and perhaps even had a serious mental health disorder. Her primary care doctor went so far as to tell her more than once, "All your symptoms are in your imagination." But they weren't in her imagination. In fact, Kathy turned out to have potentially life-threatening uterine fibroids that required surgical intervention, something that was only discovered after she demanded an ultrasound. She wasn't anxious, although after 9 months of being told she was crazy, who could blame her if she was? She was anemic. Rachel was also told she was imagining it. She had been trying to manage her severe pain and heavy periods with the pill for 10 years by the time she collapsed at a gig. The hospital sent her home with painkillers and a diagnosis of stress. The next time she collapsed, the hospital put her in the gastroenterology ward. 6 nights I was there on a drip. There was a woman dying of bowel cancer in the bed opposite me. It was horrible. The doctors suspected kidney stones, so they ran multiple tests around her urinary system. They all came back negative. So did her blood tests. And the more tests that came back negative, the more Rachel sensed a shift in how she was being treated. I started feeling they weren't believing me, that they thought it was all in my head. Eventually, a consultant shook his head as Rachel told him how much she hurt and told her, "We have to send you home. There's nothing wrong with you." But there was something wrong with her. Rachel was eventually diagnosed with endometriosis, a disease where womb tissue grows elsewhere in the body, causing extreme pain and sometimes infertility. It takes an average of 8 years to diagnose in the UK, an average of 10 years to diagnose in the US, and there is currently no cure. And although the disease is thought to affect 1 in 10 women, 176 million worldwide, it took until 2017 for England's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence to release its first ever guidance to doctors for dealing with it. The main recommendation? Listen to women. This may be easier said than done because failing to listen to female expressions of pain runs deep and it starts early. A 2016 study from the University of Sussex played a series of cries to parents, 25 fathers and 27 mothers of 3-month-old babies. They found that although babies' cries aren't differentiated by sex, sex-based pitch differences don't occur until puberty, lower cries were perceived as male and higher cries perceived as female. They also found that when male parents were told that a lower-pitched cry belonged to a boy, they rated the baby as in more discomfort than when the cry was labelled female. Instead of believing women when they say they're in pain, we tend to label them as mad. And who can blame us? Bitches be crazy, as Plato famously said. Women are hysterical. Hystera is the Greek word for womb. Crazy If I had a pound for every time a man questioned my sanity in response to my saying anything vaguely feminist on Twitter, I would be able to give up work for life. Irrational and over-emotional. The trope of the crazy ex-girlfriend is so common, it's been satirized by Taylor Swift in her hit song Blank Space and by Rachel Bloom in a whole Netflix series about a crazy ex-girlfriend. Women are a mystery, explained renowned physicist Stephen Hawking, while Freud, who got rich and famous off his diagnoses of female hysteria, explained in a 1933 lecture that throughout history, people have knocked their heads against the riddle of femininity. The intransigence of this feminine riddle has not gone unpunished. Women who had often done little more than manifest behaviours that were out of feminine bounds, such as having a libido, were incarcerated for years in asylums. They were given hysterectomies and clitoridectomies. Women were locked up for having even mild postnatal depression. The grandmother of a friend of mine spent her life in an asylum after throwing a scourer at her mother-in-law. At least one US psychiatric textbook, still widely in use during the 1970s, recommended lobotomies for women in abusive relationships. Of course, we've moved on from such inhumane treatment of women. We no longer lock women up and cut out parts of their brains. Instead, we give women drugs. Women are 2.5 times more likely to be on antidepressants than men. This is not to condemn antidepressants. They can be life-changing for people with mental health problems. However, it's still worth asking why women are so much more likely to be on them, because it's not simply that women are more likely to seek help. A 2017 Swedish study, in fact, found that it was men who were more likely to report depression. So why are more women being treated with antidepressants? Are women simply more feeble-minded? Does living in a world in which we don't quite fit affect our mental health? Or are antidepressants the new, and obviously preferable, lobotomy for women dealing with trauma? Freud once believed that hysteria might be linked to historic sexual abuse. He later retracted this theory, as it would have implicated too many men to be, in his opinion, credible. But recent research suggests that abuse might be linked to certain types of pain women experience, and in the wake of the Me Too global scandal, maybe it's not so incredible after all. The full answer to these questions is beyond the scope of this book. But one possible explanation for at least part of the disparity is that women are being prescribed antidepressants when they are not, in fact, depressed. Women's physical pain is far more likely to be dismissed as emotional or psychosomatic. The Swedish study, which found that men are more likely to report depression, also found that women who have not reported depression are twice as likely as men to be prescribed antidepressants. This chimes with studies from the 1980s and 90s, which found that while men who reported pain tended to receive pain medication, women were more likely to receive sedatives or antidepressants. A 2014 study, which required healthcare providers to make treatment recommendations for hypothetical patients with lower back pain, similarly found that female patients were significantly more likely to be prescribed antidepressants than men. It seems that Jentl syndrome may be at play again here. It is striking that so many of the stories women tell of undiagnosed and untreated pain turn out to have physical causes that are either exclusively female diseases or are more common in women than in men. Women are almost twice as likely to have irritable bowel syndrome as men, and 3 times more likely to experience migraines, a condition about which we know very little despite it being chronic, often deeply debilitating, and affecting 37 million Americans and 1 in 8 people in the UK. In fact, many clinical pain conditions are substantially more prevalent in women than men, and several studies over the past decades have shown that women are more sensitive to pain than men, which sheds a particularly cruel light on the finding that women are less likely to receive painkillers. There is also mounting evidence that men and women may experience pain differently. A woman's pain sensitivity increases and decreases throughout her menstrual cycle, with skin, subcutaneous tissue, and muscles being affected differently by female hormonal fluctuations. An animal study, which found that males and females use different types of immune cells to convey pain signals, may provide the beginnings of an answer as to why, although only the beginnings. Sex differences in pain remain an under-researched area, and even what we do know is not widely dispersed. Dr. Beverly Collett, who until she retired in 2015 was a consultant at Leicester's Pain Management Service and chair of the Chronic Pain Policy Coalition, told The Independent that the average GP has no idea that drugs such as paracetamol and morphine work differently in women. even if they are treated for their pain, women routinely have to wait longer than men to receive that treatment. A US analysis of 92,000 emergency room visits between 1997 and 2004 found women had longer waiting times than men, and a study of adults who presented to a US urban emergency department between April 2004 and January 2005 found that while men and women presented with similar levels of pain, women were less likely to receive analgesia, and women who did receive analgesia waited longer to receive it. A US Institute of Medicine publication on chronic pain, released in 2011, suggested that not much has changed, reporting that women in pain face delays in correct diagnosis, improper and unproven treatments, and neglect, dismissal, and discrimination from the healthcare system. In Sweden, a woman suffering from a heart attack will wait 1 hour longer than a man from the onset of pain to arrival at a hospital, will get lower priority when waiting for an ambulance, and will wait 20 minutes longer to be seen at the hospital. The reality that female bodies are simply not afforded the same level of medical attention as male bodies is often brushed aside with the riposte that, on average, women enjoy more years of life than men. But while it is true that female life expectancy remains a few years longer than male life expectancy, although that gap is narrowing as women's lives have become less prescriptive and occupational safety in male-dominated jobs has become more stringent, there is evidence to suggest that the female mortality advantage isn't exactly secure. A 2013 paper that examined trends in US mortality rates from 1992 to 2006 in 3,140 counties reported that even as mortality decreased in most counties, female mortality increased in 42.8% of them. And while men's years of good health have increased in line with their longevity, both women's longevity and active years have increased at a much lower rate. 30 years of US health data showed that, while women live on average 5 years longer than men, in Europe it is 3.5 years, those years are spent in ill health and disability. The result is that US women no longer have more active years than men, despite their longer lives. And while women account for 57% of US citizens aged over 65, they make up 68% of those who need daily assistance. In 1982, both men and women who lived to 85 could expect 2.5 further years of active healthy life. For women, that figure hasn't changed. But an 85-year-old man alive now can expect to be active and healthy until he's 89. The trend of increasing longevity and good health amongst men can also be found in Belgium and Japan. A WHO paper into women's health in the EU reported that in 2013, even in countries with some of the highest overall life expectancy in the region, women spent almost 12 years of their life in ill health. And yes, it would be nice to have some sex disaggregated data on why this is happening. A particularly troubling side effect of Jentl syndrome is that when it comes to medical issues that mainly or only affect women, you can forget about including women in trials because here the research is often lacking altogether. Premenstrual syndrome, PMS, is a collection of symptoms that include, among other things, mood swings, anxiety, breast tenderness, bloating, acne, headaches, stomach pain, and sleep problems. PMS affects 90% of women but is chronically understudied. One research roundup found 5 times as many studies on erectile dysfunction than on PMS. And yet, while a range of medication exists to treat erectile dysfunction, there is very little available for women, to the extent that over 40% of women who have PMS don't respond to treatments currently available. Sufferers are still sometimes treated with hysterectomies. In extreme cases, women have tried to kill themselves. But researchers are still being turned down for research grants on the basis that PMS does not actually exist. Period pain, dysmenorrhea, similarly affects up to 90% of women, and according to the American Academy of Family Physicians, it affects the daily life of around 1 in 5 women. The level of pain women experience on a monthly basis has been described as almost as bad as a heart attack. But despite how common it is and how bad the pain can be, there is precious little that doctors can or will do for you. A rare 2007 grant application for research into primary dysmenorrhea described its causes as poorly understood and treatment options as limited. The prescription medications which are available have serious possible side effects and are by no means universally effective. When I went to my male doctor about period pain that wakes me up at night and leaves me in a moaning fetal position in the daytime, he more or less laughed me out of the room. I haven't bothered trying again. So imagine my joy when I read about a 2013 study that seemed to have found a cure. The primary outcome of a double-blind, randomised, controlled trial of sildenafil citrate was, ladies, you may want to sit down for this, total pain relief over 4 consecutive hours with no observed adverse effects. Imagine. Created in 1989, sildenafil citrate is the medical name for Viagra. In the early 1990s, the drug was being tested as a heart disease medication. It turned out not to be great at that, but one thing participants did report was an increase in erections. Yes, all the trial participants were men. Total erectile dysfunction affects between 5 to 15% of men, depending on age, with about 40% of men experiencing it to some degree. And so, naturally, the researchers were keen to explore this alternative use for their drug. By 1996, sildenafil citrate had been patented in the US, and by March 1998, it was approved by the FDA. A happy ending for men, then. But what if the trial had included women? The outcome of the 2013 study is suggestive. The trial had to be stopped because the funding ran out, meaning the researchers did not meet their sample size and therefore could not confirm the primary hypothesis. They called for larger studies of longer duration, likely multicenter, to confirm their findings. These studies have not happened. Dr. Richard Legros, who led the study, told me he applied twice to the NIH for funding, to do a longer and larger study and also to compare sildenafil to the standard of care, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent. He was rejected both times. In each case, the grant was deemed to be in the lower half of grants submitted. It wasn't even reviewed. Legros tells me that the comments he received indicated that the reviewers did not see dysmenorrhea as a priority public health issue. They also didn't fully understand clinical trial design of dysmenorrhea trials. When I ask him if he thinks he will ever get funding, he says, "No, men don't care or understand dysmenorrhea. Give me an all-female review panel." The failure of pharmaceutical companies to step in here and capitalize on what is surely a gold-plated commercial opportunity may seem baffling, but it's quite possibly just another data gap problem. In an email, Legros told me that, for cost reasons, the pharma industry doesn't usually fund investigator-initiated projects, particularly of drugs that are available generically. And this may be where the data gap comes in. There simply isn't much research done on dysmenorrhea, which makes it difficult for pharma companies to know exactly how much money could be made on such a drug, and therefore makes it harder for them to decide to fund trials, especially if the people making the decisions happen not to be women. Legros also suggested that pharma companies may not want to risk doing tests in women in case of negative findings that would endanger the use of sildenafil in men. In short, it seems that pharma companies may in fact not see this as a gold-plated commercial opportunity, and so women carry on being incapacitated by pain on a monthly basis. Male-dominated funding panels may also explain why we have so few drugs available for uterine failure. Every day, 830 women around the world die due to complications during pregnancy and childbirth. In some African countries, more women die annually from childbirth than at the height of the Ebola epidemic. Over half of these deaths are explained as being a result of problems with contractions, often because the contractions are too weak for the woman to give birth. The only medical treatment available for women whose contractions aren't strong enough is the hormone oxytocin, which works about 50% of the time. Those women go on to give birth vaginally. Women who don't respond to oxytocin are given an emergency cesarean. In the UK, weak contractions are the reason given for a majority of the 100,000 emergency cesareans carried out each year. We currently have no way of knowing which women will respond to oxytocin, which clearly isn't ideal. All women, including those for whom it will result in a pointless and harrowing delay, have to go through the process. This happened to a friend of mine in 2017. After being in hospital in excruciating pain for 2 days, on her own for much of it, as her partner had been sent home, she was only 4 centimetres dilated. Eventually, she was taken off for a C-section, and she and the baby were fine. But the experience left her traumatised. She had flashbacks for the first few weeks after she gave birth. When she talks about the internal exams and procedures, she describes it as a violent assault. It was, she says, brutal. But what if it didn't have to be this way? What if they'd known from the beginning that she was going to need a caesarean? In 2016, Susan Ray, a professor of cellular and molecular physiology at the University of Liverpool, gave a lecture to the Physiological Society. Ray is also the director of the Centre of Better Births in Liverpool Women's Hospital, and she explained that recent research revealed that women with contractions that were too weak to give birth had more acid in their myometrial blood, the blood in the part of the uterus that causes contractions. The higher the levels of acid were, the higher the likelihood a woman would end up needing a caesarean, because oxytocin isn't, it turns out, that effective on women with an acidic blood pH. But Ray didn't simply want to be able to predict the need for a caesarean. She wanted to be able to avoid it. Together with her fellow researcher, Eva Weiberg-Itzel, Ray conducted a randomized control trial on women with weak contractions. Half of them were given the usual oxytocin, half were given bicarbonate of soda, and then given the usual oxytocin an hour later. The change was dramatic. 67% of women given just oxytocin went on to give birth vaginally, but this rose to 84% if they were given bicarbonate of soda an hour before. As Ray pointed out, the bicarb dose wasn't tailored to body weight, it wasn't tailored to the amount of acid in the blood, and the women weren't given repeated doses, so the efficacy could turn out to be even higher. This finding could not only be transformative for the tens of thousands of women a year who have what could turn out to be unnecessary surgery, not to mention saving the NHS a substantial amount of money. It could save women's lives in countries where caesarean sections are risky or not readily available. Not that you have to live in a low-income country for a C-section to be risky. You could just be a black woman living in the United States. The US has the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world. But the problem is particularly acute for African Americans. The World Health Organization has estimated that the death rate of black expectant and new mothers in the US matches that of women in much lower income countries like Mexico and Uzbekistan. Black women in America have worse health outcomes overall than white women. But when it comes to pregnancy and childcare, the comparisons score off the charts. African American women are 243% more likely than white women to die from pregnancy and childbirth-related issues. And it's not just because African Americans tend to be poorer. A 2016 analysis of births in New York City found that black college-educated mothers who gave birth in local hospitals were more likely to suffer severe complications of pregnancy or childbirth than white women who never graduated from high school. Even global tennis superstar Serena Williams is not immune. In February 2018, she revealed that she had almost died following an emergency C-section. African American women also have higher rates of cesarean section, and a 2015 study from Connecticut found that even when controlling for socioeconomic status, black women were more than twice as likely to have to return to hospital in the month following surgery. So Ray's research could be transformative here. But it looks like we aren't going to see the fruits of her labour anytime soon. When Ray discovered that the British Medical Research Council was offering funding for research that would benefit low and middle income countries, she decided to apply. And yet, despite all the data about how dangerous weak contractions can be, she was turned down. The research was not a high enough priority. So currently, we have only one treatment for women with weak contractions, and it doesn't work half the time. Compare this, Ray says, to the around 50 drugs available for heart failure. The evidence that women are being let down by the medical establishment is overwhelming. The bodies, symptoms, and diseases that affect half the world's population are being dismissed, disbelieved, and ignored. And it's all a result of the data gap, combined with the still prevalent belief, in the face of all the evidence that we do have, that men are the default humans. They are not. They are, to state the obvious, just men. And data collected on them does not, cannot, and should not apply to women. We need a revolution in the research and the practice of medicine, and we need it yesterday. We need to train doctors to listen to women and to recognize that their inability to diagnose a woman may not be because she is lying or being hysterical. The problem may be the gender data gaps in their knowledge. It's time to stop dismissing women and start saving them. Part 5. Public Life. Chapter 12. A Costless Resource to Exploit. How much will it cost? This is the first question that anyone proposing a policy initiative must answer, swiftly followed by, can we afford it? The answer to the first question will be fairly straightforward, but the answer to the second is a little trickier. It will depend on the current state of a country's economy, and that figure is more subjective than many of us think. The standard measure of a country's economy is gross domestic product, GDP, and if economics has a religion, then this is its god. It is compiled from data collected in a range of surveys and represents the total value of goods, how many shoes were manufactured, and services, how many meals were served at restaurants, a country produces. It also includes how much we all got paid and how much we, including governments and businesses, have all spent. It all sounds very scientific, but the truth is that GDP has a woman problem. The formulation of a country's official GDP figure is an inherently subjective process, explains Diane Coyle, professor of economics at Manchester University. A lot of people think that GDP is a real thing, but actually, it's a confection, with lots of judgments that have gone into its definition, and a lot of uncertainty. Measuring GDP is, she says, not like measuring how high the mountain is. When you see headlines proclaiming that GDP went up 0.3% this quarter, she cautions, you should remember that that 0.3% is dwarfed by the amount of uncertainty in the figures. Compounding this uncertainty are glaring gaps in the data used to compile the figures. There are plenty of goods and services that GDP simply doesn't account for, and the decision over which to include is somewhat arbitrary. Until the 1930s, we didn't really measure the economy with any seriousness. But that changed in the wake of the Great Depression. In order to address the economic meltdown, governments needed to know more precisely what was going on. And in 1934, a statistician called Simon Kuznets produced the United States' first national accounts. This was the birth of GDP. Then the Second World War came along, and it was during this period, explains Coyle, that the frame we use now was established. It was designed to suit the needs of the war economy, she tells me. The main aim was to understand how much output could be produced and what consumption needed to be sacrificed to make sure there was enough available to support the war effort. To do this, they counted everything produced by government and businesses, and so what governments do and what businesses do came to be seen as the definition of the economy. But there was one major aspect of production that was excluded from what came to be the international convention about how you think about and measure the economy, and that was the contribution of unpaid household work like cooking, cleaning, and childcare. Everyone acknowledges that there is economic value in that work. It's just not part of the economy, says Coyle. This was not a mere oversight. It was a deliberate decision following a fairly vigorous debate. The omission of unpaid services of housewives from national income computation distorts the picture, wrote economist Paul Studenski in his classic 1958 text, The Income of Nations. In principle, he concluded, unpaid work in the home should be included in GDP, but principles are man-made, and so, after a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, and much debate over how you would measure and value unpaid household services, it was decided, says Coyle, that this would be too big a task in terms of collecting the data. Like so many of the decisions to exclude women in the interests of simplicity, from architecture to medical research, this conclusion could only be reached in a culture that conceives of men as the default human and women as a niche aberration. To distort a reality you are supposedly trying to measure makes sense only if you don't see women as essential. It makes sense only if you see women as an added extra, a complicating factor. It doesn't make sense if you're talking about half of the human race. It doesn't make sense if you care about accurate data. And excluding women does warp the figures. Coyle points to the post-war period up to about the mid-1970s. This now looks like a kind of golden era of productivity growth, Coyle says, but this was to some extent a chimera. A large aspect of what was actually happening was that women were going out to work, and the things that they used to do in the home, which weren't counted, were now being substituted by market goods and services. For example, buying pre-prepared food from the supermarket rather than making it from scratch at home. Buying clothes rather than making clothes at home. Productivity hadn't actually gone up. It had just shifted from the invisibility of the feminized private sphere to the sphere that counts, the male-dominated public sphere. The failure to measure unpaid household services is perhaps the greatest gender data gap of all. Estimates suggest that unpaid care work could account for up to 50% of GDP in high-income countries and as much as 80% of GDP in low-income countries. If we factor this work into the equation, the UK's GDP in 2016 was around $3.9 trillion. The World Bank's official figure was $2.6 trillion. And India's 2016 GDP was around $3.7 trillion compared to the World Bank's figure of $2.3 trillion. The UN estimates that the total value of unpaid childcare services in the US was $3.2 trillion in 2012, or approximately 20% of GDP, valued at $16.2 trillion that year. In 2014, nearly 18 billion hours of unpaid care were provided to family members with Alzheimer's. Close to 1 in 9 people aged 65 and older in the US are diagnosed with the disease. This work has an estimated value of $218 billion, or, as an Atlantic article put it, nearly half the net value of Walmart's 2013 sales. In 2015, unpaid care and domestic work in Mexico was valued at 21%, higher than manufacturing, commerce, real estate, mining, construction, and transport and storage. And an Australian study found that unpaid childcare should in fact be regarded as Australia's largest industry, generating, in 2011 terms, $345 billion, or almost 3 times the financial and insurance services industry, the largest industry in the formal economy. Financial and insurance services didn't even make second place in this analysis. They were shunted into a lowly third place by other unpaid household services. You will notice that these are all estimates. They have to be, because no country is currently systematically collecting the data. And it's not because there's no way of doing it. The most common way of measuring the amount of unpaid work women do is with time use surveys. Individuals are asked to keep a time diary of their movements throughout the day, what they are doing, where, and with whom. It is because of this form of data capture, writes prize-winning economist Nancy Fulbright, that we now know that in virtually every country, women undertake a disproportionate share of all non-market work and also tend to work longer hours overall than men do. Standard time use surveys were primarily designed to measure explicit activities such as meal preparation, house cleaning, or feeding a child. As a result, they often fail to capture on-call responsibilities such as having to keep an eye on a sleeping child or be available for an adult with a serious illness while you get on with something else. Another data gap. Time use surveys that explicitly aim to capture such responsibilities demonstrate that the market value of on-call care, even at a very low replacement wage, is significant. But like with travel data, this kind of care work is often lost within personal and leisure data. Fulbright points to studies of home-based care for HIV/AIDS in Botswana, which estimated the value of services per caregiver at about $5,000 per year, a number that would substantially increase estimates of total spending on healthcare if it were included. The good news is that these surveys have been on the increase in many countries. In the first decade of the 21st century, more than 87 such surveys were concluded, more than the total in the entire 20th century, writes Fulbright. But reliable time use information is still lacking for many countries around the world. And measuring women's unpaid work is still seen by many as an optional extra. Australia's scheduled 2013 time use survey was cancelled, meaning that the most recent Australian data available is from 2006. Coyle tells me that she can't help being a bit suspicious that the original decision not to bother counting work in the home was informed by gender stereotypes in the 1940s and 50s. Her suspicion seems entirely justified, and not just because the original rationale for excluding women's work was so flimsy. With the rise of digital public goods like Wikipedia and open source software, which are displacing paid goods like encyclopedias and expensive proprietary software, unpaid work is starting to be taken seriously as an economic force, one that should be measured and included in official figures. And what's the difference between cooking a meal in the home and producing software in the home? The former has largely been done by women, and the latter is largely done by men. The upshot of failing to capture all this data is that women's unpaid work tends to be seen as a costless resource to exploit, writes economics professor Sue Himmelwhite. And so, when countries try to rein in their spending, it is often women who end up paying the price. Following the 2008 financial crash, the UK has seen a mass-cutting exercise in public services. Between 2011 and 2014, children's centre budgets were cut by £82 million, and between 2010 and 2014, 285 children's centres either merged or closed. Between 2010 and 2015, local authority social care budgets fell by £5 billion. Social security has been frozen below inflation and restricted to a household maximum, and eligibility for a carer's allowance depends on an earnings threshold that has not kept up with increases in the national minimum wage. Lots of lovely money saving. The problem is, these cuts are not so much savings as a shifting of costs from the public sector onto women, because the work still needs to be done. By 2017, the Women's Budget Group estimated that approximately 1 in 10 people over the age of 50 in England, 1.86 million, had unmet care needs as a result of public spending cuts. These needs have become, on the whole, the responsibility of women. Cuts have also contributed to a rise in female unemployment. By March 2012, 2 years into austerity, women's unemployment had risen by 20% to 1.13 million, the highest figure for 25 years. Meanwhile, male unemployment stood at almost exactly where it had since the end of the recession in 2009. Unison found that by 2014, there had been a 74% increase in women's underemployment. In 2017, the House of Commons Library published an analysis of the cumulative impact of the government's fiscal consolidation between 2010 and 2020. They found that 86% of cuts fell on women. Analysis by the Women's Budget Group, WBG, found that tax and benefit changes since 2010 will have hit women's incomes twice as hard as men's by 2020. To add insult to injury, the latest changes are not only disproportionately penalising poor women, with single mothers and Asian women being the worst affected, they are benefiting already rich men. According to WBG analysis, men in the richest 50% of households actually gained from tax and benefit changes since July 2015. So why is the UK government enacting policy that is so manifestly unjust? The answer is simple. They aren't looking at the data. Not only are they not quantifying women's unpaid contribution to GDP, the UK government, like most governments worldwide, also aren't gender analysing their budgets. By repeatedly refusing, most recently in December 2017, to produce a comprehensive equality impact assessment of its budgets, the UK government has arguably been operating illegally since the Public Sector Equality Duty, PSED, came into law. Part of the 2010 Equality Act, the PSED requires that a public authority must, in the exercise of its functions, have due regard to the need to eliminate discrimination and advance equality of opportunity. In an interview with The Guardian, WBG's director, Eva Neachert, couldn't see how the Treasury could fulfil its legal obligations without completing a formal assessment. Were Treasury ministers deliberately seeking to hide inconvenient truths about the impact of its policies on women, she wondered. If they were, it would be profoundly foolish, because spending cuts on public services are not just inequitable, they are counterproductive. Increasing the amount of unpaid work women have to do lowers their participation rate in the paid labour force, and women's paid labour force participation rate has a significant impact on GDP. Between 1970 and 2009, almost 38 million more women joined the US labour force, increasing the female participation rate from 37% to nearly 48%. McKinsey calculates that without this increase, US GDP would be 25% smaller, an amount equal to the combined GDP of Illinois, California, and New York. The World Economic Forum, WEF, has also found that increasing female labour participation has been an important driver of European economic growth in the last decade. By contrast, Asia and the Pacific reportedly loses $42 billion to $47 billion annually as a region because of women's limited access to employment opportunities. There are still further gains that could be made. There's a 12% employment gap between men and women across the EU. The figure varies between 1.6% in Latvia and 27.7% in Malta, a 13% gap in the US, and a 27% gap worldwide. The WEF has calculated that closing this gap would have massive economic implications for developed economies, boosting US GDP by as much as 9% and Eurozone GDP by as much as 13%. In 2015, McKinsey estimated that global GDP would grow by $12 trillion were women able to engage in the paid labour force at the same rate as men. But they aren't, because they simply don't have the time. Both the OECD and McKinsey have uncovered a strong negative correlation between time spent in unpaid care work and women's paid labour force participation rates. In the EU, 25% of women cite care work as their reason for not being in the paid labour force. This compares to 3% of men. In the UK, women with young children are employed for shorter hours than those without children, while for men, it is the other way round. This matches the situation in Mexico, where, in 2010, 46% of mothers of very young children were in paid employment, compared to 55% of women in households without children. The figures for men were 99% and 96%, respectively. In the US, female paid employment is actually pretty high amongst younger women, but it sharply declines after motherhood, which is being progressively delayed. The failure to collect data on women's unpaid workload can also stymie development efforts. Myra Buvinich, senior fellow at the UN Foundation, points to a history of initiatives in low-income countries littered with training programs that have failed because they have been built on the mistaken assumption that women have plenty of free time backed by limited data on women's time-intensive work schedules. Women may sign up for these programs, but if the initiatives don't account for women's childcare demands, women don't complete them. And that's development money down the drain, and more women's economic potential wasted. In fact, the best job creation program could simply be the introduction of universal childcare in every country in the world. Of course, it's not just childcare that affects female paid employment. Elder care also takes up significant amounts of women's time, and demand is set to increase. Between 2013 and 2050, the global population aged 60 or over is projected to more than double. By 2020, for the first time in history, the number of people aged 60 and over will outnumber children younger than 5. And along with getting older, the world is getting sicker. By 2014, nearly a quarter of the world's disease burden was in people aged over 60, most of it chronic. By 2030, an estimated 6 million older people in the UK, nearly 9% of the total population, will be living with a long-term illness. The EU has already passed this milestone. 10% of its population, around 50 million citizens, are estimated to suffer from two or more chronic conditions. Most of them are 65 years and over. In the US, 80% of over 65s have at least one chronic condition, and 50% have at least two. All these care needs, the US has an unpaid labour force of 40 million providing care for sick and elderly relatives, affect women's ability to work. Female carers are almost 7 times more likely than men to cut back from full-time to part-time work. US women aged between 55 and 67 who care for their parents unpaid reduce their paid work hours by, on average, 41%, and 10% of US women caring for someone with dementia have lost job benefits. In the UK, 18% of women who care for someone with dementia have taken a leave of absence from work, and nearly 19% have had to quit work either to become a carer or because their caregiving duties become a priority, while 20% of female carers have gone from working full-time to part-time. This is the case for only 3% of male carers. If governments want to tap the GDP source of women's increased participation in paid labour, it's clear that they have to reduce women's unpaid work. McKinsey found that a decrease in the time British women spent doing unpaid work from 5 to 3 hours correlated with a 10% increase in their paid labour force participation. As we've seen, introducing properly paid maternity and paternity leave is an important step to achieving this, by increasing female paid employment and potentially even helping to close the gender pay gap, which is in itself a boon to GDP. The Institute for Women's Policy Research has found that if women had been paid equally in 2016, the US economy would have produced $512.6 billion more in income, which is 2.8% of 2016's GDP, and represents approximately 16 times what the federal and state governments spent in fiscal year 2015 on temporary assistance to needy families. A more dramatic government intervention than the introduction of paid parental leave would be to invest in social infrastructure. The term infrastructure is generally understood to mean the physical structures that underpin the functioning of a modern society: roads, railways, water pipes, power supplies. It doesn't tend to include the public services that similarly underpin the functioning of a modern society, like child and elder care. The Women's Budget Group argues that it should, because, like physical infrastructure, what the WBG calls social infrastructure yields returns to the economy and society well into the future in the form of a better educated, healthier, and better cared for population. Arguably, then, this exclusion of care services from the general concept of infrastructure is just another unquestioned male bias in how we structure our economy. Take early childhood education, ECE, and high-quality formal childcare, including for very young toddlers and infants. Investment in these can actually reduce overall education spend because it lowers the level of investment required in remedial education. It also improves cognitive development, educational achievement, and health outcomes for children, particularly socio-economically disadvantaged children, all of which increases productivity in the long run. A report on two ECE pilot studies found that by the age of 40, US children who received ECE were more likely to be employed, 76% versus 62%, and to have higher median annual earnings, $20,800 versus $15,300. They were also more likely to own homes, 37% versus 28%, a car, 82% versus 60%, and to have savings accounts, 76% versus 50%. ECE was also found to have wider indirect effects of a lower crime rate, resulting in lower law enforcement costs. The report concluded that investing in ECE had a greater positive impact on long-term economic growth than business subsidies and would lead to an extra 3.5% growth in GDP by 2080. But despite all these potential gains, social infrastructure investment is often overlooked, in no small part because of the data gap when it comes to unpaid work. This gender data gap has led, Nancy Fulbray explains, to its payoff being understated. In fact, the payoff could be huge. In the UK, it would generate up to 1.5 million jobs, compared to 750,000 for an equivalent investment in construction. In the US, an investment of 2% of GDP in the caring industries would create nearly 13 million new jobs, compared to the 7.5 million jobs that would be created by investing 2% of GDP in the construction sector. And because the care sector is, currently, a female-dominated industry, many of these new jobs would go to women. Remember that increasing female employment drives GDP. The WBG found that investing 2% of GDP in public care services in the UK, US, Germany, and Australia would create almost as many jobs for men as investing in construction industries, but would create up to four times as many jobs for women. In the US, where two-thirds of newly created care jobs would go to women, compared to only one-third of newly created construction sector jobs, this investment would increase women's employment rate by up to 8 points, reducing the gender employment gap by half. In the UK, the investment would reduce the gender employment gap by a quarter, a correction not to be sniffed at, giving it as women's jobs that have been hardest hit by austerity policies. As well as increasing female paid employment, and therefore GDP, by actively creating new jobs for women, investing in social infrastructure can also increase female paid employment by reducing the amount of unpaid labour women have to do. The employment rate of UK mothers with children aged 3 to 5 is 6% lower than the OECD average. In 2014, 41% of mothers of children under 4 were employed full-time, compared to 82% of childless women and 84% of fathers. This sex disparity is partly due to societal expectations, enshrined in law via unequal maternity and paternity leave allowances, that the mother be the primary carer. But it's also because of the gender pay gap. For many heterosexual couples, it makes financial sense for the woman to be the one to reduce her working hours because she tends to be the one who is earning less. And then there's the cost of childcare. Recent research from the UK's Department for Education found that 54% of mothers who don't work outside the home said they would like to, if they could obtain, convenient, reliable and affordable childcare. But on the whole, they can't. Childcare costs in the UK have outstripped general inflation over the last 10 to 15 years, with UK parents spending 33% of their net household income on childcare against an OECD average of 13%. Unsurprisingly, therefore, The UK has highly unequal take-up of childcare by socio-economic levels, particularly compared to other OECD countries. And this also has a knock-on effect on female paid employment. 29%, this rose to nearly 50% of low to middle income mothers, of British women told McKinsey that returning to work after having a child is not financially viable, twice the number of men who say the same thing. It was a similar story in New York, which in 2012 was found by Pew Research Center to be the most expensive state in the US for childcare. The Center for American Progress found that before the city's mayor introduced universal preschool, more than one third of New York families waitlisted for childcare assistance lost their jobs or were unable to work. In Los Angeles, where preschools face steep funding cuts, an estimated 6,000 mothers are set to give up about 1.5 million work hours, costing an annual total of $24.9 million in lost wages. There is an easy fix to this problem. One study found that, with consistent childcare, mothers are twice as likely to keep their jobs. Another found that government-funded preschool programs could increase the employment rate of mothers by 10%. In 1997, the government of Quebec provided a natural experiment where they introduced a subsidy for childcare services. Following the introduction of the subsidy, childcare prices fell. By 2002, the paid employment rate of mothers with at least one child aged 1 to 5 years had increased by 8%, and their work hours had increased by 231 per year. Since then, several other studies have found that the public provision of childcare services is strongly associated with higher rates of women's paid employment. Transferring childcare from a mainly unpaid, feminized, and invisible form of labor to the formal paid workplace is a virtuous circle. An increase of 300,000 more women with children under five working full-time would raise an estimated additional £1.5 billion in tax. The WBG estimates that the increased tax revenue, together with the reduced spending on social security benefits, would recoup between 95% and 89% of the annual childcare investment. This is likely to be a conservative estimate because it's based on current wages. And like properly paid paternity leave, publicly funded childcare has also been shown to lower the gender pay gap. In Denmark, where all children are entitled to a full-time childcare place from the age of 26 weeks to 6 years, the gender wage gap in 2012 was around 7% and had been falling for years. In the US, where childcare is not publicly provided until age 5 in most places, the pay gap in 2012 was almost double this and has stalled. We like to think that the unpaid work women do is just about individual women caring for their individual family members to their own individual benefit. It isn't. Women's unpaid work is work that society depends on, and it is work from which society as a whole benefits. When the government cuts public services that we all pay for with our taxes, demand for those services doesn't suddenly cease. The work is simply transferred onto women, with all the attendant negative impacts on female paid labour participation rates and GDP. And so the unpaid work that women do isn't simply a matter of choice. It is built into the system we have created, and it could just as easily be built out of it. We just need the will to start collecting the data and then designing our economy around reality rather than a male-biased confection. Chapter 13. From Purse to Wallet. It was 11 p.m. on the evening of the UK's 2017 general election. The polls had been closed for 1 hour, and a rumour had started doing the rounds on social media. Youth turnout had gone up. A lot. People were pretty excited about it. My contacts are telling me that the turnout from 18 to 24-year-olds will be around 72% to 73%. Finally, the youth have turned out! Hashtag GE2017, tweeted Alex Cairns, CEO and founder of The Youth Vote, a campaign to engage young people in UK politics. A couple of hours later, Malia Bouattia, then president of the National Union of Students, put out the same statistic in a tweet that went on to be retweeted over 7,000 times. The following morning, David Lammy, Labour MP for the London Borough of Tottenham, tweeted his congratulations. 72% turnout for 18 to 25-year-olds. Big up yourselves. Hashtag GE2017. His tweet received over 29,000 retweets and over 49,000 likes. There was just one problem. No one seemed to have the data to back any of this up. Not that this stopped news outlets from repeating the claims, all citing either unverified tweets or each other as sources. By Christmas, Oxford English Dictionaries had named youthquake as its word of the year, citing the moment young voters almost carried the Labour Party to an unlikely victory. We were witnessing the birth of a zombie stat. A zombie stat is a spurious statistic that just won't die, in part because it feels intuitively right. In the case of the UK's 2017 general election, we needed an explanation for why, contrary to nearly all polling predictions, the Labour Party did so well. An unprecedented increase in youth turnout fitted the bill. Labour had courted the youth vote, the story went, and it had almost won. But then, in January 2018, new data emerged from the British Electoral Survey. There was some debate over how definitive the data was, but the famous youth quake was downgraded to more of a youth tremor at best. By March, no one credible was talking about a youth surge without substantial caveats, and the 72% statistic was firmly on life support. The British youthquake that never was had a fairly short life for a zombie stat. This is partly because while secret ballots preclude the possibility of absolutely conclusive polling data, we do at least collect data on them. A lot of data, in fact. Elections are hardly an under-researched topic. But when a zombie stat emerges in an area where data is scarce, the stat becomes much harder to explode. Take the claim that 70% of those living in poverty are women. No one is quite sure where this statistic originated, but it's usually traced to a 1995 UN Human Development Report, which included no citation for the claim. And it pops up everywhere, from newspaper articles to